You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankfort, welcoming you to Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Donald Trump didn't invent the concept of fake news, although he certainly has popularized it, using the term to describe anything in the national media that has cast him in an unfavorable light, regardless of whether it's fact or fiction. Of course, the issuance of fake news by our government to justify wars and interventions from Vietnam to Iraq, from the Dominican Republic to Grenada, they number in the hundreds going back to the earliest days of our country. It should come as no surprise. All governments engage in the production of fake news, the United States particularly, since it emerged unscathed as a dominant superpower after World War II, arguably more than most. On every one of those occasions, the national media has played a major role in getting the public to support the government's actions. Over the last several years, but particularly so since the election of Donald Trump, on certain key issues, the media appears to be a step or two ahead of the government. Consortium News is one online website that has consistently challenged the arguably fake news that has become standard fare of the mainstream media and all the TV news networks. Those two combined have helped reignite the Cold War and taken the country to the threshold of what may yet become another devastating shooting war. Joe Loria, a seasoned foreign correspondent and regular contributor to Consortium News, has recently taken over the helm of the new site following the death of its founder, award-winning journalist Robert Perry, who you heard a number of times on Takes on the World. At 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking with Joe Loria in Washington about the state of the U.S. media today, about the importance of alternative news sources, and particularly about the coverage of Russiagate and the war in Syria. Loria was my guest last December 13th, during which we discussed a disturbing article he had written for Consortium News, quote, "How Russiagate Rationalizes Censorship," end quote. In the article, he described how even liberal organizations dedicated to press freedom, like Fairness and Accuracy in Media and the American Civil Liberties Union, had succumbed to the heat of the moment and legitimized the censorship of anyone challenging the basis for blaming the Russians and Vladimir Putin personally for Trump's election. "The Russiagate hysteria," he wrote December 4th, "has spread beyond simply a strategy for neutralizing Donald Trump or even removing him from office into an excuse for stifling U.S. dissent that challenges the new Cold War," end quote. That was from Joe Loria, who I'll be talking with at 20 minutes past the hour. What makes what he will have to say particularly timely was the announcement last Friday that the Democratic National Committee, headed by party insider Tom Perez, had filed a suit against Russia, WikiLeaks, and the Trump campaign for meddling the 2016 presidential election. When I first saw the story, I thought it was a joke, that the Democratic National Committee would really want to raise the issue of the 20,000 internal DNC emails plus the thousands of messages taken from the computer of John Podesta, Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign chair, I found bewildering. Those emails, after all, exposed the conniving of the DNC to deny Bernie Sanders the party's nomination and revealed Hillary Clinton telling the bankers at Goldman Sachs that she could say one thing to corporation folks, but then something else to the voters. Quite apart from the fact that three intelligence agencies concluded but could not prove that the emails had been hacked by the Russians, the Democratic National Committee chair Tom Perez, with this lawsuit, seemed to be sending a message to the Sanders supporters, who have been engaged in making the party more responsible to the needs of the people, that nothing has really changed within the Democratic Party hierarchy. On my last program, I mentioned to my guest Gareth Porter that the word "alleged" had apparently disappeared from the vocabulary employed by mainstream as well as many self-styled alternative media hosts when it comes to actions that may or may not have been committed by Russia or Syria. Not being present on the ground, they are forced to rely on smartphone reports from witnesses who may or may not have specific agendas that would raise questions about the accuracy of their reports. This is particularly true in Syria, where an NGO operating in territory held by Islamic jihadists, namely the White Helmets, is funded by Britain, the U.S., and nations in the Persian Gulf, opposed to the Syrian government and its ally Iran. The latest example of this phenomenon was, we are told, without any direct evidence, was a chlorine gas attack by the Syrian government on Douma, a Damascus suburb long held by jihadists who have been shelling civilian areas of the capital controlled by the government. The lack of evidence did not stop President Trump, in concert with France's President Emmanuel Macron and British Prime Minister Theresa May, from carrying out a bombing on what they claimed, without any proof, were Syrian chemical weapons and research facilities outside of Damascus. The three heads of state apparently could not wait for international chemical weapons inspectors to arrive and determine what exactly had happened in Douma. In the nationally televised press conference in which they described the attack, neither Defense Secretary James Mattis nor head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, mentioned, nor were they asked by members of the press in attendance, about the potential dangers to the surrounding civilian population if indeed the buildings targeted actually contained dangerous weapon-grade chemicals. There was one intrepid British journalist, however, Robert Fisk, who shuns press briefings, and chose to go to Douma and find out for himself and his readers of the Independent of London what had happened there. You may have heard Fisk in the past on Democracy Now! And on Takes on the World a little more than a decade ago when I interviewed him in his seafront Beirut. Fisk had been based in Beirut since 1975 and thus is the dean of all Middle East correspondents. Since you are not likely to hear what he found in Douma or read his story anywhere else, I am going to quote from it at length. Quote, "This is the story of a town called Douma," this story begins, "a ravaged, stinking place of smashed apartment blocks and of an underground clinic whose images of suffering allowed three of the Western world's most powerful nations to bomb Syria last week. There's even a friendly doctor in a green coat who, when I track him down in the very same clinic, cheerfully tells me that the gas videotape, which horrified the world, despite all the doubters, is perfectly genuine." War stories, however, have a habit of growing darker, Fisk continues. For the same 58-year-old senior Syrian doctor then adds something profoundly uncomfortable. The patients, he says, were overcome not by gas, but by oxygen starvation in the rubbish-filled tunnels and basements in which they lived on a night of wind and heavy shelling that stirred up a dust storm. As Dr. Assam Rahabiani announces this extraordinary conclusion, it is worth observing that he is, by his own admission, not an eyewitness himself, and as he speaks good English, he refers twice to the jihadi gunmen of Jaish al-Islam, the Army of Islam, in Douma as terrorists, the regime's word for their enemies, and a term used by many people across Syria. Am I hearing this right, wonders Fisk? Which version of events are we to believe? By bad luck, too, he writes, the doctors who were on duty that night on 7 April were all in Damascus giving evidence to a chemical weapons inquiry, which will be attempting to provide a definitive answer to that question in the coming weeks. France, meanwhile, has said it is proof, quote, proof, chemical weapons were used, and U.S. media have quoted sources saying urine and blood tests showed this, too. The World Health Organization has said its partners on the ground treated 500 patients, quote, exhibiting signs and symptoms consistent with exposure to toxic chemicals, end quote. Fisk then notes that inspectors from the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW, were at the time blocked from coming to the site of the alleged gas attacks themselves, ostensibly because they lacked the correct UN permits. But before we go any further, Fisk goes on, readers should be aware that this is not the only story in Douma. There are many people I talked to, he says, amid the ruins of the town who said that they had never believed in gas stories, which were unusually put about, they claim, by the armed Islamist groups. These particular jihadis survived under a blizzard of shellfire by living in other people's homes and in vast wide tunnels with underground roads carved through the living rock by prisoners with pickaxes on three levels beneath the town. So the story of Douma is thus not just a story of gas, or no gas, as the case may be, points out Fisk. It's about thousands of people who did not opt for evacuation from Douma on buses that left last week alongside the gunmen with whom they had to live like troglodytes for months in order to survive. I walked across this town quite freely yesterday without soldier, policeman, or minder to haunt my footsteps, he writes, just two Syrian friends, a camera, and a notebook. Happy to see foreigners among them, happier still as the siege is finally over, they are mostly smiling, those whose faces you can see, of course, because a surprising number of Douma's women wear a full-length black hijab. I first drove into Douma as part of an escorted convoy of journalists, he writes. But once a boring general had announced outside a wrecked council house, "I have no information," I just walked away. It was a short walk to Dr. Rahabiani, who told him, quote, "I was with my family in the basement of my home 300 meters from where here on the night, but all the doctors know what happened. There was a lot of shelling by government forces, and aircraft were always over Douma at night. But on this night, there was wind and huge dust clouds began to come into the basements and cellars where people lived. People began to arrive here suffering from hypoxia, oxygen loss. Then someone at the door, a white helmet, shouted, 'Gas!' and a panic began. People started throwing water over each other." Yes, the video was filmed here. It is genuine, Dr. Rahabiani told Fisk. But what you see are people suffering from hypoxia, not gas poisoning. The white helmets, write Fisk, the medical first responders, already legendary in the West, but with some interesting corners to their own story, played a familiar role during the battles. They are partly funded by the Foreign Office, and most of the local offices were staffed by Douma men. "I found their wrecked offices not far from Dr. Rahabiani's clinic," writes Fisk. "A gas mask had been left outside a food container with one eyepiece pierced, and a pile of dirty military camouflage uniforms lay inside one room." "Planted, I ask myself," said Fisk. "I doubt it," he writes, referring to, if not confirming, accusations that the White Helmets are allied with the jihadists. The place, he notes, was heaped with capsules, broken medical equipment, and files, bedding, and mattresses. "Of course you must hear their side of the story, but it will not happen here," adds Fisk. A woman told us that every member of the White Helmets in Douma abandoned their main headquarters and chose to take the government-organized and Russian-protected buses to the rebel province in Idlib, with the armed groups with which the final truce was agreed. Again, my earnest questions about gas were met with what seemed genuine perplexity. "How could it be," Fisk asked, "that Douma refugees who had reached camps in Turkey were already describing a gas attack which no one in Douma today seemed to recall? It did occur to me, once I was walking for more than a mile through these wretched prisoner groin tunnels, that the citizens of Douma lived so isolated from each other for so long that news, in our sense of the word, simply had no meaning to them." Syria, concludes Fisk, doesn't cut it as a Jeffersonian democracy, as I cynically like to tell my Arab colleagues, and it is indeed a ruthless dictatorship, but that couldn't cow these people, happy to see foreigners among them, from reacting with a few words of truth. End quote. Those are the words of Robert Fisk, the Vienna Middle East journalist, writing in the Independent of London about his trip to Douma. They tell a very different story from what you have read or heard anywhere else. As for the White Helmets, subject of an Oscar-winning documentary and much heralded in the U.S. and the West, British Foreign Minister Boris Johnson can be seen on a YouTube praising the group and bragging that the U.K. has given it £32 million as part of a larger $65 million package, which includes money from the USAID to international development. Corroborating what Fisk found, reporter Pearson Sharp of One America News, a conservative Christian TV network and supporter of President Trump, interviewed doctors and witnesses at the clinic, which can be viewed on YouTube. They also said that there was no chemical attack and that the strangers came into the clinic, shouted "gas," and then filmed the reaction. Bringing you news from such respected sources as Robert Fisk, as well as others that you've never heard about, the challenge which to believe by the mainstream media has been one of my objectives since Takes on the World first went on the air in 2001, and what you just heard is just one example. There is an off-again, on-again report that Russia is about to send the S-300 defense missile system to Syria in the wake of Israeli and Western attacks and Syrian military bases, and that there will be catastrophic consequences for any nation's air force that launches an attack on those bases. In response, Israel's Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman told Israel's Ynet News that, quote, "One thing should be clear, if someone fires on our planes, we will destroy them. What's important to us is that the weapons defense system that the Russians transfer to Syria are not used against us," meaning, of course, that Israel should be able to attack other countries with impunity, which it has done since it became a state. Last Friday marked the fourth week that Palestinians in Gaza began nonviolent protests near the Israeli border, demanding an end to the decade-long siege by Israel and a right to return to their Palestinian homeland from which they or their families were expelled in 1948. An estimated 10,000 Palestinians, the same number as the previous Friday, showed up. Arrayed against them on the other side of the fence, as on three previous Fridays, was a row of Israeli snipers, their rifles rested on a berm, ready to shoot, absolutely no danger from any Palestinian. In those four Fridays, they have killed 39 protesters, none of whom were armed, and wounded several thousand more, according to medical reporters on the ground. This time, one of the four killed was a 14-year-old boy who is shown in photos standing with friends when gunned down. The White House has made no comment on the protests since April 6th, when Jason Greenblatt, President Trump's Middle East envoy and an unabashed supporter of Israel, warned Palestinians to stay 500 meters away from the border fence while condemning leaders and protesters, quote, who call for violence or who send protesters, including children, to the fence, knowing they may be injured or killed, end quote. None of what their soldiers have been doing in Gaza have bothered most Israelis, and certainly not the country's political leadership. But the same cannot be said of the reaction to the refusal of Jerusalem-born actress Natalie Portman to come to Israel to accept a $2 million Genesis Prize Award, what they refer to as a Jewish Nobel. According to Portman's representatives, recent events in Israel have been extremely distressing to her, and she does not feel comfortable participating in any public events in Israel, and that she, quote, cannot in good conscience move forward with the ceremony, end quote. Needless to say, the response in Israel to her statement of conscience has been, with but a handful of exceptions, vitriolic, with one Israeli official saying she should lose her Israeli citizenship. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine. طفلة تنتطي فوسا قزح طفلة تنتطي فوسا قزح من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we return to an examination of censorship issues on U.S. campuses and feature a fascinating panel of speakers from the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs Conference held in March of 2018. Back to back, you will hear Dr. Barry Trachtenberg, Professor of Judaic Studies at Wake Forest University, followed by Rabab Abdulhadi, the besieged Professor of Middle East Studies at San Francisco State University. As you will hear, it is an interesting pairing of speakers. The introductions are by Grant Smith of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, once again, good morning, and thank you for your patience as we try and stay on time and on schedule today. Our next panel addresses an issue at the very heart of our country's identity, the right to free speech. In an effort to control debate about Israel on college campuses and elsewhere, pro-Israel groups have increasingly sought legal measures to limit and even criminalize speech of those concerned about Palestinian human rights. Our two panelists, will offer insight into these efforts and will explain how to push back against First Amendment encroachments. Our first speaker is Dr. Barry Trachtenberg, the Michael R. and Deborah K. Rubin Presidential Chair of Jewish History at Wake Forest University. A scholar of Jewish history and of the Nazi Holocaust, Dr. Trachtenberg earned his Ph.D. in history at UCLA and a postgraduate diploma in Jewish studies at Oxford University. Prior to joining Wake Forest in 2016, he was an associate professor and director of programs in Judaic Studies and Hebrew Studies at the State University of New York's University at Albany, and interim director from 2010 to 2012 of the University Center for Jewish Studies. He's the author of two books, including the newly released 2018 book, The United States and the Nazi Holocaust, Race, Refuge, and Remembrance, which he'll be signing later today. On November 7th of last year, he testified before a House Judiciary Committee hearing on anti-Semitism on college campuses, which sought expert opinions on legislation that, if passed, would legally define anti-Semitism in a way that many fear is designed to curtail activity critical of Israel. Today he will address challenging the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, pushing back against Jewish exceptionalist politics.
It's really an honor for me to be invited to speak here today. It's nice because at Congress they give you a buzzer with just 5 minutes, and so it's nice to have 18 before the red light appears. It's really an honor for me to be on this panel with Rabab, who has been a model of scholarly activism on the issue of justice for Palestinians, who's been a target in an unrelenting campaign to discredit her and her work. So I'm very proud to be your warm-up act for today. So as we know, for several years, there's been a global campaign to thwart the nonviolent BDS movement. This has involved governments around the world, including, of course, Israel, but also the UK and France. And many state and local governments here in the United States have likewise declared that citizens risk being punished for choosing not to do business with Israel. We know that these statutes are a clear violation of free speech guarantees, and while they tend to not stand up to constitutional challenge, they're enacted by politicians who are pandering to what they incorrectly see as American Jewish voters' monolithic views of Israel. Now, although it's a nonviolent form of protest, the boycott is frequently equated with terrorism, and its supporters are cast as extremists and anti-Semites. And just a quick aside to sort of highlight the absurdity of this legislation, New York State, where I used to live, is boycotting North Carolina, where I now live, over the bathroom bill that discriminates against transgendered persons. And yet that same year they passed anti-BDS legislation saying that boycotts are inherently discriminatory. So there you go. However, regardless of whether or not this sort of legislation is constitutional, the effect of it is to suppress criticism of Israel and thereby sustain the occupation of Palestinians. As a consequence, scholars and activists regularly engage in self-censorship, so reluctance to criticize Israel, for fear of being slandered, in some cases, for even having their livelihoods threatened and destroyed, as we know. The campaign against BDS has also been effective at distracting our attention away from focusing on the brutality of the occupation itself. As the scholar and activist Ayala Ben-Yeshai has recently argued, while we argue about the merits of BDS, the occupation only intensifies, and too often we don't recognize our own complicity within it. As American taxpayers whose government sends billions in U.S. military hardware, as scholars whose universities set up strategic partnerships with Israeli universities and businesses, and, speaking for myself, as a professor of Jewish history whose professional organizations are likewise implicated in support for the occupation. Another front in this campaign to restrict freedom of political expression was the attempt by members of Congress in the last year to introduce legislation called the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, which would amend Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 by declaring that anti-Semitism is a violation under it. Now, on the face of it, the legislation looks encouraging, and one might reflexively be supportive, particularly since the rise of the Trump presidency, which has emboldened white supremacists to once again target Jewish communities. And it's for this reason likely that the measure sailed through the Senate in the last legislative session. Yet the truth is that this legislation is also an attempt to suppress student activism and academic speech that is in support of Palestinian human rights. The effect of this bill is to define opposition to Israel as anti-Semitism, to equate Judaism with Zionism, and to sanction schools who permit Palestinian human rights activism from occurring on their campuses. Yet, as with legislation against BDS, this act would likely not withstand constitutional challenges, but it too is already shaping how college campuses talk about anti-Semitism and contend with political activism against the occupation. Now, this legislation was prompted by growing activism on college campuses that challenged the Israeli occupation by groups such as Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace, who are often working to pass BDS resolutions on their campuses. Backers of this legislation, such as Anti-Defamation League, AIPAC, the Simon Wiesenthal Center, and Christian Zionist groups, have disingenuously portrayed campuses as ever more hostile and dangerous to Jewish students, and that American universities are hotbeds of anti-Semitism because of threats from pro-Palestinian activists. They've produced a set of academic studies, and I put that in quotes, that purport to document a rise of anti-Semitism on campuses. Yet a close reading of most of these studies demonstrates that in each of them, the researchers' definition of anti-Semitism includes activities that are critical of Israel and American complicity in the occupation. Given that student activism against the occupation is on the rise, these studies are more accurately read as a testament to the tenacity of pro-Palestine students than of rising anti-Jewish hatred. Now, to be clear, attacks on Jewish students for being Jewish are unquestionably repellent and must not be tolerated. The truth is that the old racist and religiously based anti-Semitism, such as we saw in Charlottesville this summer, where torch-bearing marchers carried Nazi and Confederate flags and chanted, "You Jews will not replace us," and murdered a protester, is still present in the United States and requires vigilance and persistence resistance. However, as their testimony before Congress attests, the backers of this bill care very little about combating white supremacy, for that would put them at odds with the current administration and supporters in Congress. It's not what this legislation addresses. It's primarily concerned with curbing political speech that threatens the continuing occupation of Palestine. The Anti-Semitism Awareness Act relies upon the State Department's classification of anti-Semitism, which is itself appropriated from the working definition of anti-Semitism of the European Monitoring Center on Racism and Xenophobia, a definition that was created for the purposes of research and not governmental policy. As well intentioned as the State Department's concern for anti-Semitism may be, it defines anti-Semitism so broadly so as to include criticism of Israel as a Jewish state, declaring Israel to be a racist state, or by refusing to accept that Israel is an expression of Jewish self-determination. Even the author of the original working definition, the free speech advocate Ken Stern, who is opposed to the academic boycott of Israel, has testified that the definition was not drafted and was never intended as a tool or to target or to chill speech on a college campus. In fact, the State Department's definition upon which the legislation was based is so poorly constructed that it's entirely unusable. For example, it insists that an instance of anti-Semitism is, quote, accusing Jewish citizens of being more loyal to Israel or to the alleged priorities of Jews worldwide than to the interests of their own nations, unquote. This, of course, is one of the founding premises of Zionism. It's also one of the founding premises of the pan movements that emerged at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, such as pan-Germanism or pan-Slavicism. Later, we saw pan-Arabism or pan-Africanism. Right? The first half of the 20th century, in particular, showed us that, as with other marginalized groups, Jewish citizenship in any particular country could not so easily be taken for granted. The founders of Zionism consequently concluded that regardless of where in the world they live, Jews have more in common with one another than they do with non-Jews. Such arguments can be traced back to the founder of Zionism himself, Theodor Herzl, who argued in his seminal 1896 book, The Jewish State, that anti-Semitism is an inescapable fact of modern existence, and Jews are a people, one people, and that for that reason it's useful for us to be loyal patriots. Elsewhere, the definition states that denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination, denying Israel the right to exist, is an example of anti-Semitism. This, of course, ignores the plurality of views that exist within the Jewish community regarding Israel. As much as the ADL, AIPAC, and other groups testifying to Congress would like to assert, they are unequivocally not the spokesperson for all of American Jewry, a majority of whom feel that the U.S. should not support Israel's occupation of the West Bank. Indeed, since the first stirrings of Zionism in Europe, groups of Jews in America rejected Jewish nationalism. For some, it was a matter of faith. For others, it was out of loyalty to the United States. And for others, it was out of commitment to universalist ideals of equality and human rights. For many Jews today and since 1948, the State of Israel is decidedly not an expression of Jewish self-determination. For another, the question of Israel's right to exist is not the same thing as its right to exist as a Jewish state if that existence is predicated on the displacement and oppression of the non-Jews within its borders. Given the flaws in the State Department's definition of anti-Semitism, it has no place in campus speech codes. Although discussions around Israel and Zionism may often be uncomfortable for its supporters and detractors alike, something that I witness in my classes most semesters, It's the responsibility of students and educators to foster dialogue and not to limit it, to understand the historical implications of our speech, and to allow for the meaning and definition of fraught terms to develop and change as a consequence of informed deliberation and debate. It's profoundly difficult to create a definition of anti-Semitism that can be used for legislative purposes. The root of the current debates on anti-Semitism lies in a seemingly intractable problem of how to critique Jewish collective power in a way that does not immediately resonate with a long history of anti-Semitism. Throughout the last 1,000 years of European history, Jews were regularly characterized as an incommensurate and exceptionalist element who sought to undermine the established religious, political, or economic order. They're accused of being killers of Christ and of seeking to repeat this offense through the murder of innocent Christian children. Such accusations at times led to blood libels, pogroms, first conversions, and exile. And in more recent centuries, Jews were characterized simultaneously as usurpers of national identities, as disloyal citizens, capitalist schemers, and revolutionary subversives. Such allegations led to discriminatory legislations, riots, expulsions, and physical violence. In the early 20th century, Jews were branded as a biological and racial threat, and entire armies rose up to exterminate them. In each of these moments, Jews were imagined as a united group that possessed power and authority far beyond their actual numbers. Yet in 1948, with the founding of Israel as a solution to anti-Semitism, the situation changed dramatically. For the first time, a significant number of Jews identifying as a national group gained actual and not military power. I'm sorry, not imaginary power. Today, the state of Israel has borders, police, courts, military, a nuclear arsenal, political parties, and a marginally democratic system, at least for its Jewish citizens. Like all other states, its actions are and must permitted to be a matter of public debate and discourse both within the Jewish community and outside of it. Yet speech that's critical of Israel strikes many still as inherently anti-Semitic. The problem in part is that we're still learning how to talk about Israel's actual power and repeated claims to represent Jews all over the world in ways that do not immediately echo much older and anti-Semitic depictions of imaginary Jewish power. This is in part because of the long history of anti-Jewish hatred in the West, but it's also because, as we see in legislative initiatives such as the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act and the Movement to Stop BDS, to characterize any speech that's critical of Israel as intrinsically anti-Semitic has been a highly effective tool employed by those who uncritically support every action of Israel and seek to stigmatize its critics. Considering the multiple and constantly shifting forms of anti-Semitism that have emerged since the term anti-Semitism first appeared in Germany at the end of the 19th century, it's wrong for Congress to establish legal authority on a definition of anti-Semitism that's so contested. To insist that Israel cannot be protested or objected to mandate that Jewish collective power cannot be analyzed or debated, or to conclude that Jews, because they were once victims of one of humanity's greatest genocidal crimes, are somehow immune from becoming perpetrators of acts of violence against other peoples, would only reinforce the anti-Semitic belief that Jews are a fundamentally different people. Moreover, and perhaps most dangerously of all, attempts to broaden the definition of anti-Semitism to encompass phenomena that are clearly not anti-Semitic can only make it more difficult to recognize, isolate, and oppose actual anti-Semitic hatred when it does appear. Although it appears that the legislation in Congress is stalled, it may be that its advocates will still get their way. Last month, Congress affirmed the appointment of Kenneth Marcus, an Israel lawfare strategist, the group that has been targeting Rabab, as head of the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights. Over the objection of Democrats and civil rights organizations and attorneys, Marcus will now be in a position to implement the State Department's definition and continue his decades-long effort to suppress academic speech and campus activism that's critical of Israel. So, to conclude, in the invitation letter, we were asked to offer some signs of hope in these difficult times. It's true, we were. So the first piece I want to say is that during the break, I checked my phone and I saw the news that Bibi Netanyahu was just questioned today for 5 hours by the police. So I take that as a good sign, you know. On the eve of the AIPAC conference, it seems to be a good thing, and, you know, Shabbat Shalom for that. But I think if we're serious about defeating actual anti-Semitism, we also have to commit ourselves to ending the occupation of Palestine. These are intertwined issues. These are intertwined struggles. We have to recognize that anti-Semitism doesn't exist in a vacuum and to stop thinking of it in these exceptionalist ways. Instead, we need to see that the history of anti-Semitism is part of the modern world's legacy of racial discrimination and persecution. And the present moment is no exception. Instead of perpetuating a narrative of Jewish exceptionalism by declaring that somehow the only country we cannot criticize on college campuses is Israel, we might instead draw from earlier periods of American history when Jews linked their fate to that of other oppressed peoples. Just as Italian and Jewish workers organized together to form labor unions, as Jewish philanthropists and community leaders contributed to the founding of the NAACP, as Jewish college students participated in voter recruitment drives and desegregation campaigns with African Americans in the South, and religious figures helped foster post-World War II Jewish-Christian dialogues in the name of mutual understanding, Jewish Americans have an opportunity to forge alliances in the name of combating hatred and intolerance. It was a coalition of Palestinian rights organizations, both Arab and Jewish, that came together to stop the advancement of the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act in the House. The very next day, on November 8th, a petition with over 20,000 signatures was delivered to the Anti-Defamation League by Jewish Voice for Peace, demanding that the ADL stop facilitating police trainings between Israeli and American law enforcement officials. That same day, Lawfare's suit against Rabab was thrown out by a judge who recognized the weakness of their complaint. So there are reasons to hope. We will keep fighting, continue working side by side with one another to create bonds of solidarity. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Dr. Rabab Abdulhadi. She's the director and senior scholar in the Arab and Muslim ethnicities and diasporas and associate professor of ethnic studies and resistance studies at San Francisco State University. She's a co-founder and editorial board member of the Islamophobia Studies Journal, for which she is co-editing the forthcoming special issue on gender, sexuality, and racism. She's co-author of Mobilizing Democracy, Changing U.S. Policy in the Middle East, and co-editor of Arab and Arab-American Feminisms, Gender, Violence, and Belonging, which is for sale here today. Her work has appeared in 7 languages in academic journals, and she was the winner of the 2012 National Arab-American Nonfiction Book Award. As many are you aware, and as was referenced, she and San Francisco State University have been the target of a Lawfare Project lawsuit claiming that the school fosters a hostile environment for Jewish students, but that case was thrown out by a judge in November. As her bio and work show, though, she has not let this smear campaign define her career, so we are pleased to welcome her to discuss how and why the Israel lobby is suppressing free speech and academic freedom on college campuses.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me, Washington Report on Middle East Affairs and the Institute for Middle East Research Policy. I also want to begin by acknowledging that we are convening on indigenous people's stolen lands. And I want to acknowledge the people, yes, I want to acknowledge the people who are fighting day in and day out against all forms of racism and racial discrimination, from the people who are fighting against white supremacy to the people who are fighting against anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, anti-Arab discrimination, as well as people who are trying to clean up Washington. Thank you for having me. So on last week, President Wang, San Francisco State University, issued a statement saying that Zionists are welcomed on campus. He had met with members of Hillel, and he basically came out with this statement that I can share the slide with people. For my presentation, I wanted to just answer a few questions. What does the statement mean to welcome Zionists to campus? What is the history behind President Wang's statement? How does it relate to our discussion of the Israel lobby, and where do we go from here? Immediately after President Wang issued a statement, I issued a statement right away saying that San Francisco State is abandoning its social justice mission by welcoming Zionists, and I called upon people to reclaim the social justice mission of San Francisco State as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the 1968 San Francisco State's right. I also argued, as Barry has argued before me, that there is no equivalence between Zionism, Israel and anti-Semitism. They're not one and the same. What happened also, in addition to my statement, is that there were multiple statements published that day. General Union of Palestine Students published. Black Student Union published a statement along with other black student groups on campus. A new group, Jews Against Zionism, had just emerged among students and published a statement. And Jewish Voice for Peace published a statement condemning President Wang's statement. This is something that we would not have seen 15 years ago or 11 years ago when I joined San Francisco State. This is something that's really important. It also attests to the argument that Barry is making. Things are changing. The tide has turned. And I think we really need to keep that in mind. And when we know that the tide has turned, we know that the attacks are going to become more vicious and they will target us more and try to silence us. I also sent another statement last week, also citing the words of Richard Spencer, who said on Israeli TV that I'm a white Zionist, as well as Yair Netanyahu, the son of Netanyahu, who basically trashed people who argued and organized against the white supremacy in Charlottesville and said that actually organizers around Palestinian rights are more damaging to that. Obviously, we know where the alliances are. So meeting with Hillel, the president, what does Hillel stand for? And I would just read a couple of points. Wherever we stand with Israel. Hillel, actually, as a national organization that is involved in silencing us, does not allow Jewish students to belong to it who are for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. It is not allowed inside Hillel. One of the questions we are raising is, again, Zionism, Israel, and Jewishness are one and the same. Or who owns Jewishness? Barry has talked about that, so I'm not going to get into it. But we have a history of silencing Palestine at San Francisco State. So what's going on with the lawfare lawsuit that the judge dismissed on November 8th, but gave them leave to amend? So they may come back and amend, and they already said that they're going to be amending. The lawfare project is actually aided by a law firm in San Francisco that is almost 1,000 lawyers, pro bono. I have two incredible, amazing pro bono lawyers who are standing by me day in and day out, and I would not change them for anybody. So we are fighting. And justice is on our side. That's really important, too. But who is attacking Palestine at SFSU? It is what we call an Israel lobby industry network. As the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network report of 2015, it outlines who are some of these donors and the fact that the Israeli government also has put in millions of dollars in this. We're not talking about the cottage industry. We're talking about people who are quite organized. These are the list of the groups that I don't have time to go into it. The only two groups that have not directly attacked us, although we're getting public record requests, is the Brandeis Center, Kenneth Marcus, which I'm sure he's on the horizon somewhere. Friends of IDF have been involved, copied on emails, about attacking us, but they have not directly attacked us. Although we do have Israeli soldiers on campus that continue to be in active duty in the Israeli army. So we are calling this new McCarthyism, and the reason we're saying it's new, because it's exactly as McCarthyism in the 50s work. And what it does is that it attaches a terrorism label. It incites Islamophobia, uses Islamophobia by building Arabs, Palestinians as Muslims are terrorists. So immediately it goes in people's minds. It engages anti-Semitic smear. It spreads misinformation, false allegation. The university invents new rules and regulations every single time they'd like to curb freedom of speech and our ability to organize and teach. And they police activists, organizers, and scholars. They try, as the lawfare has done, as I will continue telling you, to ruin careers. Basically, the lawfare co-founder, Brooke Goldstein, said that we are going to make the enemy pay. In a video in 2016, in which she also said there are no Palestinians and Islamophobia does not exist, and also said that San Francisco State University is one of their main targets. So by trying to ruin my career, they would like to teach a lesson to other junior scholars and recent PhDs whose careers are on the lines. Watch out. This is what might happen to you. To silence people and engage in McCarthyist attacks to prevent people from speaking up, from organizing, from doing anything about justice. Basically, stay away from Palestine. They also, at San Francisco State, one of the main targets has been to starve and defund our program. That is part of my contract when I came to San Francisco State in 2007, and rely on donors, pro-Israel donors, who are pouring millions of dollars in the university and tell the university that we will continue funding you if you are able to discipline Palestinian students and silence Rabab Abdel Hadi and basically shut down the Ahmed Studies program. And one of the ways that they do it is backroom deals, lack of transparency, no accountability. A lot of this stuff is happening in secret, and they don't even release the public record FOIA request that we submit. They don't release, period. And the reason we actually have the public record request is because the university gave it to Lawfare, and my lawyers asked the university to just give us a copy of the public record that they gave to Lawfare, and they dragged their feet and finally gave us, and we don't know if they gave us everything. Or they claiming that the officer who does the compliance is not in touch with other people. And you think with a such high-profile case in a federal court, the university lawyers would be watching the whole question of compliance at what's going on, but that's what they claim. This is, I'm not going to give you all of this history, but this is from at least 2002. It goes, Palestine has been silenced, intimidated, bullied, criminalized, policed, and smeared at San Francisco State, both by organizations within and outside the university. So when we talk about a war of attrition has been declared. We're talking about groups outside of the university that are collaborating with groups within the university. So we don't see the two of them divorced from each other. In 2002, for instance, San Francisco State President, after sanctioning GOPS, Palestinian students, said, and they asked him to remove the sanction. He said, why? So you guys can go start throwing bombs in January? And he just actually said that's part of the university records. One of the things I really want to talk about is that in 2005-2006, the Palestinian students proposed to have a mural. San Francisco itself is known for murals. Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo lived in the Mission District, painted murals. San Francisco State has multiple murals on its walls. So Palestinian students wanted to build a mural. And this is the initial, this is the first rendition that was painted, proposed by two artists, Dr. Faya Kaweis, a Palestinian artist, and Dr. Susan Green, a Zionist Jewish artist. And if you notice on the side, on your left side, you see Handala, the cartoon character of Najil Ali, carrying a key. On it, it's written Al-Awda, return, and on the other hand, he's carrying a pen, because the pen also signifies the Palestinian saying, Al-Kalima al-Bundukiyya, my word is my sword, that, or my gun, that words are really important to emphasize the intellectual value of learning and teaching in Palestine. Because when you don't have passport, the only thing you have is your education, right? And you don't have a say. And the San Francisco State University president opposed Handala, the key, and the Al-Awda. And he wasn't the only one. Jewish Community Relations Council and the Zionist organizations did. And he said that this cartoon in particular by Najil Ali, where the kid, the cartoon character, the non-existent cartoon character, throws a stone at the Israeli flag, actually gives him nightmares, makes him wear bulletproof vest, and has to have therapy. This is the final approval of Handala of the key. We had to remove in 2007 Handala, the key, and Al-Awda, and basically put in its place Sabr, cactus. The two things have happened. One is that the cactus is long living. It doesn't die. But two is that on the day of the unveiling of the mural, all Palestinian students and their allies came to the mural unveiling wearing T-shirts with Handala on them. And Handala now remains part of our oral history. In 2006, it continues with the JCRC also trying lobbying San Francisco State to not to have a conference of Al-Awda that was organized by students. In 2009, following the Gaza, 2008-2009 Gaza, a war on Gaza, San Francisco State College Republicans and the Israel team organized an event supporting Palestine, condemning Hamas. This was the approved poster. But this was the unapproved poster that went up that basically throws the shoes at La ilaha illallah Muhammad Rasulullah and says this is throw a shoes at Hamas flag and win prizes. The poster stayed up. Students took it down. Palestinian, Muslim, Black, Latinx, indigenous students Asian, they all took it down. But the university, they're not going to take it down because there's freedom of speech. Watch out to see what else. After the second anniversary of the mural, when Omar Barghouti came to speak about BDS, San Francisco State President canceled searches we were conducting for two faculty lines to build the program. His chief of staff testified at the Board of Supervisors opposing the calls to lift the blockade of Gaza and obstructed a reception we were trying to do with diplomats from Arab and Muslim majority countries to ask them to send their children to our university to learn. The campaign escalates more in 2013, even though President Wong, the new president, met with the Arab community. After his investiture, he immediately took a trip, all-paid trip to Israel. And we were gearing up to the Ahmed proposal. So the linkage between this is that we were building the program. They have already canceled the searches. They have already starved the program. The program now ends up being one person, one faculty member with no operating budget, no staff, no other faculty. And now is the time to go for the kill. So the attack escalates because we were about to institutionalize the program. Because once the program is institutionalized, it doesn't matter. If you have person, you don't have person. It works. So in 2013, Israel lobby groups called Ahmed, Arab Muslim and Ethnicity and Diaspora Studies Initiative at the time, and Gobs, accused us of glorifying the murder of Jews. San Francisco State President did not investigate, but immediately condemned anti-Semitism. And for 7 months stayed silent when I was being attacked left and right. He also condemned speech, and he was reprimanded by free speech groups in San Francisco and collaborated with the Israeli consulate and the FBI in investigating students. In 2014, I was going on a sabbatical, and I led a delegation to Palestine, in which we began to talk with An-Najah National University about setting up a memorandum of understanding, collaboration, because our university president wanted the university to become a global university and engage with other institutions. So I was really acting upon his wishes, because I have relations with Palestinian universities. I don't really need to formalize them in order to have them happen. I was doing it. This is when, in the delegation, we met with Nabil al-Kurd and Sheikh Jarrah. Disappeared. Okay. Anyway, it may be done. And then they started accusing me of terrorism, anti-Semitism, and also accused me of criminality, misuse of university taxpayers' funds to go to Palestine, because we're not allowed to be going and learning about Palestine. Taxpayers' funds should be used to build bombs and nuclear weapons and kill people and fund Israel and its occupation. And they demanded criminal investigation. I was audited by the College of Ethnic Studies, by the university administration, and every single audit came out saying that I did nothing wrong. All these allegations are unfounded. The university took 20 days to publish a public statement just to say these are the foundings. 20 days they resisted. And in the meantime, the lobby wasn't happy, so they petitioned the controller of the state of California to investigate me further. San Francisco State ordered 5-year audit of my international travel. Not a single question was about missing receipts or a penny. Every question was political. Why are you doing this? Why are you building? Why there is an MOU with An-Najah National University? What does this mean? Why does she travel to Palestine? At the same time, the provost revoked my trip to Palestine. That's a week before the State Department issued an advisory not to travel. So this was not as a result of the advisory. This was before the advisory. In the fall 2014, we passed the memorandum of understanding. The president and the provost meeting with the university, with the College of Ethnic Studies, we discussed how would the Ahmed Studies program would be supported. And the provost twice said to me, we, in front of everybody, we do not fund Holocaust deniers. No reason. There is no reason. I teach actually the Holocaust and Jewish history and Jewish studies in all my courses and so on. But President Wong maintained silence. Nobody rose to my defense. We were able to approve the minor, but the Senate unanimously approved it in spring 2015. President Wong promised to reinstate the faculty lines, and we began to work on something called the Edward Said Scholarship. That was donated by one of the graduating students who wanted his university to have a scholarship so when his daughters go to the university, they can apply for it and have excellent education. The main resident, Zionist resident on campus, tried to obstruct the Edward Said scholarship, but Maryam Said, Wadi'a, and Najla intervened and made it happen, and we now have the Edward Said scholarship. In spring 2014, after we passed the minor, now we have a minor, we have the Edward Said scholarship, we have the memorandum of understanding. How are they going to get rid of us? I mean, there needs to be certain. So they escalate further attacks, and this happens during, we go on a delegation to Palestine, the prisoner, labor, and academic delegation. We hold two conferences, one with Bir Zeit University, one with Al-Najah National University. We observe military tribunals of children who are being held in Israeli courts. We go to unrecognized Naqab, and we come back and we report. We build reporting and we issue a statement. So San Francisco, the university hosts Nir Barakat, the racist mayor of occupied Jerusalem, who slings a machine gun and calls for the killing of Arabs. So students attacked, went and protested, and other students organized a hunger strike. This is the delegation, and this is where we're meeting with the family of Muhammad Abu Khadir. Okay, now it's, why is it? Okay, this is the protest. Then we get put on the Canary Mission, myself and the students, and they give away their home addresses, their work. Some of our students receive sexual threats of violence. President Wang issued a statement to apologize to Nir Barakat and re-invite him to campus. In the summer, the university hires independent investigator who concludes that students, yes, did disrupt the speech, but it was against him and Israel, and there was no violence involved, and it was not about anti-Semitism. It was against Israel. In the fall of 2016, we have this past year attacks after attacks. Campus Watch, Middle East Forum launched a petition to demand that Al-Najah, that the agreement with Al-Najah ends. They call Palestinian universities terrorist universities. They quote Anti-Defamation League, by the way. They accused me of terrorism. Truth Revolt also calls for me to be fired. This is the petition. Canary Mission. And then David Horowitz, the Canary Mission put out wanted ads at, can I have 2 more minutes? Wanted ads, that basic wanted style ads that all over 26 posters were found. Students took them down. The police said there were no cameras. All of a sudden there were no cameras that day. And there was nothing. They saw nothing. Faculty was very supportive. Majority of organizations, I don't have time to say, this is part of a campaign. This is the lab. This is the poster that appeared on campus. All over campus, including on the garage of the administration building, that everybody in the administration went to park and saw the poster and did not do anything about them. We passed, during that period, we got 2 courses approved, the Palestinian Mural as Art of Resistance at Edward Said. GOBS held its standing room only celebration of the mural. The students held weekly teach-ins to protest the coming of Trump. This is the anniversary, the mural anniversary. Come on, okay. And in February, they held a Know Your Rights Fair, which is now also under investigation and attack. And they also organized events to support Palestinian prisoners who were on hunger strike in April. On May 3rd, we have another set of posters, wanted style ads, second set of posters appearing on campus. And in June, the lawfare lawsuit that you've heard about, and I actually only found out about it from Campus Watch tweets because nobody in the university bothered to tell me. And I was not appointed a lawyer until a month afterwards. That's why I sought and found my lawyers. We refused to be derailed. We organized a big conference on Constitution Day with co-organized with other colleagues at the university. We had very big participation. But on September 21st, Horowitz again puts, this is the posters. Okay, and let me just go back. Yeah. What's the response? This is what the students, Associated Students, did. They put up the Palestinian flag. They published posters, hate speech is not free speech. They said we will not be silent. And we will not be silent. What we do, we continue to do. We continue to teach our classes that are full to the capacity. We continue to do with no resources, public education programs, using the classrooms to bring the community, the faculty, the students, multiple people together to organize every single day. And we continue to teach Palestine. And I'm very proud to announce that in 2 weeks we will be holding 2 conferences at Bir Zeit University and Najah National University on teaching Palestine, pedagogical praxis, and the indivisibility of justice. Because we will not be silenced. We will not be stopped. We will not be derailed. Justice will prevail. Thank you.
You have been listening to Dr. Barry Trachtenberg, Professor of Judaic Studies at Wake Forest University, and Dr. Rabab Abdulhadi, Professor of Middle East Studies at San Francisco State University. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To hear the program later in the day, we realize 8 a.m. on Sunday morning is awfully early for some, or to listen to the program at any other time of the week via the archive found on WZBC homepage, simply click on Archive, go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. However, each program is on this archive for only 2 weeks. After 2 weeks, to reach our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر من مخيم. Monitors are moderate in all things. Health is life. Excess is death. The monitors are helpful. Happiness comes from helping others.
They love thy young and old.
Hooray.
They fuel the common cause.
Oh boy.
We hope they always stay.
Bravo.
And that is why we pray. Dear God, bless each one of them.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The BBC World Service asks, who's pushing conspiracy theories? What a cheek! Maybe they are. Last weekend, BBC World Service trending programme asked, who's pushing the Syria conspiracies, taking a close look at two people critical of London media's interpretation of the alleged Douma chemical weapons attack? They were Sarah Abdullah and Vanessa Bealey. Tonight, we ask, are the conspiracy theories coming from them or from private think tanks like Chatham House, which the BBC report uncritically? Also, the Zadists taking on everything President Macron stands for. 7,000 joined squatters near Nantes in western France to defend their buildings from 2,500 riot police and bailiffs. At Zad, the defence zone, they call it, police have given them until 14th of May to get out. How long can they last? And MI5 at the BBC, does it matter that MI5 worked to prevent a socialist government? By going through the personnel files and making sure no left-wing journalists got promoted. And the mysterious contract killing of Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya. The London media started saying that Putin killed her without presenting any evidence. Yes, she was writing articles critical of him when she was shot dead in her tower block lift in October 2006. But she was writing articles critical of a lot of people, including the Chechen mafia. So what do we know about who killed her and why? But we begin with the story about the BBC and their programme Trending. Now, Martin Summers, the BBC really looking at what is effectively a kind of Twitter tag about the Duma attacks, and saying that there were actually a couple of Twitter accounts, a couple of individuals running them, that were getting far more followers than any of the BBC journalists were, and that this was, they were peddling conspiracy theories.
Well, I mean, everybody accuses people they don't like of being conspiracy theorists and therefore of getting it wrong. And, you know, we've got the, everybody throwing mud around here. And obviously the average person, if they're not really following it closely, will find it difficult to work out who is actually telling the truth. But I think the idea that the mainstream media always get it right, and that the critical voices of independent journalists are always wrong, is frankly idiotic. The real problems that we face in Syria are a huge kind of lack of knowledge about what's actually going on in the general population, and, you know, psychological warfare games being played by NATO intelligence services to deliberately muddy the waters. And, they openly boast that that's what they do. The White Helmets, for example, are definitely funded by Britain and other Western powers. There's no doubt about that. Nobody disputes it. They were set up as an organisation by James Lemessurier, who's a former British Army officer based in Turkey. And the idea that they are somehow independent, non-governmental organisation, is frankly laughable. And it looks pretty clear that they staged the event in Duma. That's what the people that were taken by the Russians to The Hague to testify yesterday said, and they were, you know, people from the hospital where the incident was supposed to have occurred. Nevertheless, the damage is done. The average population believe the government's story because they haven't got time to look into any further details. And, you know, if you've got the weight of the government of the country saying this is what happened, then people, unfortunately, tend to go along with what is actually extremely dubious information. And the consequences of this could be absolutely catastrophic. I mean, we're very lucky that this didn't lead to a conventional weapon exchange between NATO forces and Russian forces. It didn't happen because the Russians showed restraint. But there's no particular reason why they should show restraint. Under international law, when those missiles came in over the Syrian border, and for example, from Akrotiri in Cyprus, under international law, it would be absolutely legitimate for both the Syrian and Russian forces to attack Akrotiri and to go and try and kill British personnel who are responsible for attacking them. That's what international law says. And the West pretensions that they're obeying international law by engaging in these adventures is patently wrong. There is no international law basis for what they've done. Now, what they might argue is, there's a higher law, the moral law. But in that case, we've ripped up international law. And, of course, in that case, the Russians and the Syrians have got every right to fire back because there is no international law. Under international law, existing international law, we've got the right to fire back. And, of course, what they did do is shoot down as many of the incoming missiles as they could. But, of course, there either is international law, and under international law they are allowed to fire back. They chose not to because they're showing restraint. Or there is no international law, in which case they've got every right to fire back because there's no rules anyway. And, of course, if there is a no-rules fight in the Eastern Mediterranean, the Russian military will win. NATO's whole fleet-based armed forces are obsolete. the Russians have rendered them obsolete. But that's the situation that we're in. We're very lucky that we didn't have a worse situation last week than the one that's transpired. But, of course, it's extremely tense and very dangerous.
OK, so let's have a listen now to the first part of a few clips I've got from this BBC World Service trending programme about the white helmets. So let's have a listen to that one now.
As we're recording this, chemical weapons inspectors are trying to get into Douma. But Mike Wendling has been looking into the conflicts from a different perspective. You've been looking at the information and misinformation that's been flowing back and forth online.
That's right, Jonathan. And let me just point out right away that just like on the ground in Syria, the online propaganda conflict has numerous actors. It's highly confusing, it's highly complex, it's extremely hard to tell what's real and what's not. However, we've been zooming in on one particular group of activists. Despite all the uncertainty, despite the investigation you just mentioned now, these people are certain that what they believe is the truth.
And you've been spending a little bit of time digging into this, haven't you? And sort of outlining the key characters online. Who are they?
Yes, quite a bit of time, actually. And to tell you this story, I'm going to talk you through just one Twitter account.
Okay.
Although one that's actually one of the most influential when it comes to part of the Syrian conflict online. Let me show you this picture.
Okay, so what I'm seeing is a young woman wearing a bright red dress. It looks like a typical kind of holiday picture, like if you get on Instagram, loads of people upload this kind of picture.
Yeah,
all the time.
Quite a
selfie,
a stylish shot.
Yeah,
she's sitting on some steps.
Sure,
floral print dress. And this particular account, her name by the way is Sarah Abdallah. This particular account posts many of these pictures, just Sarah by herself. Sometimes maybe a view of nature, like something out of a window, a forest, but not much else. So, like you say, it seems pretty normal. What people post on social media all the time. But then there's the actual tweets, the actual messages this account sends out. They're tweets like these.
The history of Syrian false flags exposed. Reports of chemical weapons attack in rebel-held town of Douma are fabricated. The goal of such reports is to aid terrorists.
And all of this has got her a huge following on Twitter. More than 125,000 followers, to be exact.
That's huge. I mean, that's more than a lot of journalists get.
Yeah, that's a good point. More than a lot of journalists, a lot of top journalists, including some who have been covering the Middle East for years, including some of our colleagues here at the BBC.
Well, there's a compliment. More people following Sarah Abdallah than these BBC correspondents. And I'm joined on the line now from France by Vanessa Bealey, who's another one of the people who have been called. I guess, Vanessa, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Okay. Have you actually been called a Twitter troll? Am I right?
Actually, Tony, thanks for having me on. I'm kind of lost track of the insults that have been flung in my direction by a series of mainstream media outlets, including the BBC. But yes, I'm quite sure that in among some of the monikers they've given me, there is Russian troll, yes.
What do you make of this Sarah Abdallah account, then? This is someone that they say has been peddling massive amounts of disinformation and eclipsing the BBC's own journalists on Twitter.
Well, I suggest that's a reflection on public consensus regarding the BBC journalists. I mean, regardless of who Sarah Abdallah or even regardless of who I am, the very fact that a Twitter commentator, I mean, Sarah, as far as I know, is exclusively on Twitter, whereas, of course, I've just returned from 5 weeks inside Syria, most of it spent in eastern Ghouta, Damascus and Douma. If a Twitter commentator such as Sarah Abdallah is eclipsing the BBC coverage, particularly of the Syrian conflict, then I would be extremely concerned at the BBC. And rather than attacking the Twitter commentator, I would be looking very closely at why public consensus is turning against the BBC.
Well, in that same programme broadcast by the World Service twice last weekend, they also mentioned you, Vanessa. So let's have a listen to that clip now.
The top influencers in this anti-white helmets network call themselves anti-war, but at the same time, they're calling for the bombing of emergency services. John Kelly mentioned another influential account in there, that of Vanessa Bealey. Now, we know a bit more about Bealey than we do about Sarah Abdallah. She describes herself as an independent journalist, and she has more than 30,000 Twitter followers. We asked her for an interview. We sent her a list of questions. In response, she called our story a, quote, blatant attempt to silence independent journalism. But John Kelly says that what she's doing is not journalism at all.
We've looked at dozens of these disinformation campaigns. What we found in the Syria case was a pattern of online behavior, which was very close to things we've seen before. In fact, when you're looking at these disinformation campaigns, a lot of the same characters show up for every party, you know, which is one of the ways that you can tell that it's a disinformation campaign as opposed to an organic groundswell or kind of organic emergent conversation about something.
Cue the spooky music. Anyway, Vanessa, is that true what they say? Did they ask you for an interview? Did they send you questions? Because you didn't appear on their piece.
I'm assuming this is related to Mike Wendling of BBC Trending, correct?
That's right, that's the programme, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he contacted me the first time a few months ago when The Guardian ran the initial sort of smear piece into anybody that was exposing the white helmets, but predominantly myself, Eva Bartlett, Tim Anderson, and 21st Century Wire. Then I'm just having a quick look back through my emails. He then contacted me on April the 16th, so when I was actually inside Syria. I told him to send me over. He didn't make any indication or give me any indication that he was going to have me on the BBC. He simply said that he was writing an article and he wanted me to respond. So he then sent over a series of questions, which frankly were like a police inspector's report, asking me to justify various evidences that I put forward. For example, would I describe myself as an independent journalist? Have I or 21st Century Wire received funding for your work from the Syrian government or its allies? Extraordinary question.
Well, I mean, sorry, but I mean, isn't it simple for you to just answer that one? I mean, have you?
Yeah, of course I have. I responded to Wendling, I will tell you exactly when, on April the 17th, so one day after he had sent the question through, and I responded to his email in full. My response on the funding is quite simply, if he's going to pursue the line that I am being funded by the Syrian government or by the Russian government or by any of these entities or affiliated entities, he would be entering the territory of slander. So I think that was a pretty clear response on my part. But yes, I answered every single question that he sent me.
And I suppose, you know, you could say he's funded by the British government and the white helmets are funded by the British government.
Pretty much every actor inside Syria that is destabilising Syria has some degree of financing from the British government, either directly or covertly, via a number of intermediaries that act as plausible deniability when the assets on the ground are caught committing crimes against the Syrian people, yes.
What do you make of what the upshot has been of this? Apparently, half of the world is being told by its media that the Douma attack was a genuine attack by the Assad government. Oh, actually, they usually use the word regime because they don't like them, usually calling a regime if they don't like the government. And the other half of the world is being told that actually it's fake and that the idea was just to create an excuse for a missile strike. So where do you stand on this and how do we make sense of it?
Well, I mean, I think what is extraordinary, and I think people are losing that in the conflicting information war that is obviously happening, but that's, you know, that is to be expected. I mean, if you have a car crash, you will have two conflicting reports on that car crash to the insurance company. To expect only 10 days after the event actually happened, or sorry, now it's more than that, for there to be any level-headed conclusion as to who was behind this attack, who, whether it was true or not, is insane. To carry out a tripartite unlawful act of aggression using more than 100 Tomahawk-type missiles against a sovereign nation with no substantiation except for alleged offences is probably, I mean, this has to warrant the title of a supreme war crime. And yet that is now getting buried in the conflict between those who are saying there was no chemical weapon attack, as you quite rightly point out, and those who are saying there was. Now, I went into Douma 3 days ago, in fact, just before I left Syria, and I spoke to doctors, to medical staff inside the medical point where the victims of that night's attack. Now, I put attack in inverted commas because the majority of those doctors and medical staff told me there was an attack because this was an ongoing military campaign to liberate Douma from Jaish al-Islam, a Saudi-financed terrorist group. And there was an attack. People were emerging from the tunnels and from the basements of their houses with smoke inhalation and dust inhalation. And that was what was bringing them into the hospital. What then happened, the White Helmets and a number of other actors on the ground entered the hospital crying chemical weapon attack. They then doused the children who had been affected by the smoke inhalation with water. And remember that there is an 11-year-old boy, Hassan Diab, who's giving evidence today in The Hague with OPCW, explaining that entire event. But, you know, this wasn't only confirmed by doctors and medical staff. We walked around Douma about 700 metres, in an area 700 metres away from where the attack allegedly took place. And everybody that we spoke to really just laughed when we said, was there a chemical weapon attack? They said, of course not. You know, we wouldn't be here right now if there had been. We wouldn't be here and life wouldn't be continuing as normal. There was nothing, no chemical weapon attack on that night. So, you know, from my perspective, the fact that we attacked Syria, we being the US, France and the UK with Israel in a surveillance role, is quite incredible. And this is setting a precedent. I mean, we've now attacked a sovereign nation based on zero evidence, not even a dodgy dossier.
We'll have a listen now to the final clip from the BBC's trending programme last weekend, which makes an attempt to find somebody independent to make some sort of give us some advice and commentary and narrative on the power of social media, because clearly people like you, Vanessa, and Sarah Abdullah seem to be worrying people at the BBC that people are more interested in getting their news from social media than they are from them. So let's have a listen to this final clip now.
To try and make sense of this, I went to an objective source on social media in Syria. I spoke to Scott Lucas. He's a professor of international politics at the University of Birmingham here in the UK. He's the editor of a news and analysis site called EA Worldview.
If they had simply been an individual account on Twitter that is just blaring out Assad good, opposition bad, Syrian army good, White Helmets rescuers bad. If it was just a single account on social media, well, now you just say, okay, that's just part of the chatter. That's part of the white noise that you put up on a day-to-day basis. But the ability of social media, of course, is for these folks to connect and to magnify their individual voices by getting people to retweet what they put out, even if it has no basis in fact, even if it is in fact flagrant agitation or disinformation. And if you get a dozen and then dozens and then hundreds of people to spread your unfounded assertions, then you start to have influence. And then if you get someone like an organized entity like the Russian state that takes notice of you, that actually likes what you're doing, then you make this leap into supposedly becoming, quote, a journalist.
So there he is, Scott Lucas from the University of Birmingham. He apparently is... I was expecting to hear a British voice, but no, it is an American. Martin Summers, what do you make of his commentary there on what's happening with social media? He's effectively saying that social media has enabled an entire group of people to get together and counter what the government is telling us is true.
Well, that's right, and that's what they don't like about it. The question is what they're saying true or false, which, of course, he doesn't bother to engage in. He's just basically trying to say that, professional journalists and academics decide what truth is, and everybody else has just got to suck it up. But he doesn't actually enter into any discussion of what's true and false in the situation at all. And they don't really want to enter into a discussion about that, because in actual fact, all the evidence is against them. And of course, the psychological warfare operations in which NATO engages. We do. It's a fact that British Army has Brigade 77, which has 1,000 members, all of whom are officers, and they spend all day, every day, on social media pretending to be people other than they are in order to try and sway public opinion. That's a fact.
Vanessa, are you clear that you did everything you could to actually have your voice heard on this World Service programme? Because obviously the World Service has got a tremendous reach.
I responded to the questions. I mean, I wasn't aware that I could do any more than that. I responded very honestly and very openly to the question. Out of my response, they took about two sentences. I'd also quite quickly like to say, I mean, Professor Lucas is wheeled out as a so-called neutral commentator on particularly the White Helmets, but on Syria in general. However, he has very strong links to Mayday Rescue, to Dima Musa, who is a member of Mayday Rescue. Mayday Rescue is the intermediary that was set up by James Lemessurier, the creator of the White Helmets. He created the White Helmets in March 2013. 1 year later, he set up Mayday Rescue to basically funnel British government funds into the White Helmets. Now, Scott Lucas has very clear connections to that organization. He has a number of other very clear connections to think tanks and to organizations that are supporting, or at least to a degree whitewashing, some of the terrorist groups such as Ahrar al-Sham on the ground inside Syria. And he has cited Mustafa al-Hajj Yusuf, the White Helmet leader in Khan Shihun, who has himself called for the unity of ISIS, Nusra Front, and a number of other terrorist groups. He's called for the shelling of civilians in Damascus in 2014, and he has endorsed the killing of prisoners of war and the execution of prisoners of war and theft from civilian homes. So this is just one of the so-called reliable witnesses that Lucas is relying upon. I recently did a debate with Lucas on Al-Mayadeen. At the end of this debate, which involved four people, including Lucas, myself, a representative from the Russian UN mission in Geneva, and a professor from Egypt based in Washington, Lucas's only response was to call myself and the Russian representative from the UN mission liars. So as your other guest, as Martin Summers, has just said, he does not ever address the evidence, neither does the BBC, neither do any of these mainstream outlets who have conducted these smear campaigns. They simply conduct ad hominem attacks to try and discredit the activists, the journalists, the reporters, the Twitter personalities who are pushing back against the mainstream narrative on Syria, but they never address the facts or the evidence.
So when the BBC announced Scott Lucas as an objective person, they're lying.
Yes, categorically.
They also said about you and Sarah Abdullah that you're calling for the bombing of the emergency services in Syria.
That is complete nonsense. I mean, what both of us have made very clear is that the White Helmet cannot be described as a humanitarian organisation. All of the evidence from inside Syria points to the fact that they work extremely closely and collaborate with Nusra Front, which is al-Qaeda inside Syria. Civilian testimony from inside Syria has stated that they have participated in torture, in executions, in mopping up after Nusra Front executions. And we've seen members of this organization filming themselves, by the way, climbing over the dismembered corpses of prisoners of war and enjoying the parading of a severed head during that murder of Syrian Arab army soldiers. And there are a number of videos showing the White Helmets participating in the brutality of the various terrorist organizations, including in East Aleppo, where their center was only 200 meters from al-Mashhad Square, where Abdullah Isa, the 12-year-old Palestinian child, was beheaded by Nur al-Din Zinki. So this group clearly was embedded and is embedded with terrorist groups in Syria that are committing atrocities against the Syrian people, and as such, they do not qualify for the international ruling regarding protection of humanitarian organisations inside Syria.
No, they
very
don't.
Clear.
They certainly don't. And also, there are special forces from the United States. We know at least two bases in Syria now, and British special forces.
There's more than 20. US bases or UK bases?
I was thinking US, and there's UK and French special forces in Syria.
Yeah.
This conflict, are we going to see, do you think, it develop more into open confrontation between the Russians and the NATO countries?
Well, I think there was a very interesting statement from the Russian representative, and I can't remember his name, but at the OPCW. And he said that we have to be prepared for further false flag events to try and escalate the military conflict between Russia and the US coalition on Syrian soil. I mean, this was very clearly what the Douma incident was about. And actually what was interesting, I was in Damascus when the Tripartite Alliance bombed Syria, and Russia didn't fire one air defense missile in anger. It was entirely left to Syria to defend itself, and it did a very good job of it. And what is also interesting, Tony, is that the OPCW has put out a statement saying that the Baze, so-called chemical weapon manufacturing plant that was targeted by that missile attack, did not have on site any chemicals. So again, that has demonstrated that the reasoning for this attack was entirely false. Not only had the Douma chemical weapon attack not even, you know, hardly dried on the paper and certainly not been investigated, but the claim that the Jamaya and the Baze the technological labs and manufacturing sites were making chemical weapons is also proven to be false.
I mean, isn't there an even bigger journalistic failure in the failure of the Western press to even question the wisdom of bombing a chemical weapons plant?
Yes. I mean, I actually did put out a question on Twitter the other day. To what degree do the mainstream media outlets question how the British government, the US government, EU member states are acting under international law? I mean, you know, if we all took international law as a benchmark for our journalism, it would be very clear right now who is violating that international law and who is adhering to it. And that is surely what journalism has a duty to do, but they're failing to do that.
Well, you sent me also a fascinating clip from the BBC's Hard Talk, where what we had was the Syrian MP, Faraz Shahabi, and he's from Aleppo, talking to Stephen Sacker. So I hope you can stick with us for another minute or so, Vanessa, to have a little listen to an excerpt from the BBC's Hard Talk.
11 million people, at least, from your country, pretty much half your country's population, has had to flee its home. So when you say to me, this isn't about Bashar al-Assad, it's about Syria, the Syrian people defending themselves, half of the Syrian people have been forced to flee their homes. Your country is ruined. This conflict has ruined your country.
Ask the ones who left. Why did they leave? And you will find that more than 90% of them left because they wanted to escape from jihadi terrorism that NATO supports. Please, and when you have the Saudis and the Qataris, which are the most backward, radical regimes in the world, pouring money, pouring petrodollars, and bringing 250,000 jihadi mercenaries to our country, this is what's going to happen to us. Exactly. I agree with you. We will have a huge tragedy. We will have big suffering. But at the end, we have to look at the causes. Look, we are saying we are with democratic elections. We want reform. We want drastic reform. We want improvement. We want liberty. We want democracy. But who's going to give us democracy? Jihadi radicalism going to give us democracy?
Mr. Shahabi,
who said we're not defending Assad? We are defending secular Syria.
All right.
And actually, I mean, I suppose he could have also said what you were saying, defending the rule of law, Vanessa.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think here was the rhetoric that Saka used. I mean, half of Syrians have left Syria. That's a lie. You know, over 7 million Syrians that are internally displaced, where have they gone? They've gone to government, Syrian government secure areas. Over 1 million have returned to Aleppo since it was liberated, since East Aleppo was liberated from the Western back terrorist occupation. I mean, you know, it's just extraordinary sensationalism that is being deployed by
okay.
the
Okay, well, look, finally, Vanessa, I wonder if you could just paint us a picture of what the NATO and Western countries' involvement is in Syria, because we know, I mean, I've spoken to ex-army people who say, oh, well, we were in Syria, but, of course, none of this has been given permission by Parliament, let alone any kind of sign-off by the British press, the British people. These are covert bases. To what extent are there Western troops in there, either training terrorists, training jihadis, or else doing the fighting themselves?
I mean, that's a very difficult question to answer accurately, but in the northeast, for example, we know now that there are probably around 20 US bases, and they're in the process of power multiplying. A very small percentage of Kurdish separatists that are looking for a separate state within Syria. And they're also, we believe, and it has been reported, retraining terrorist factions to join and power multiply the Kurdish factions, and that includes ISIS, by the way. We know from various sort of scattered reports, I mean, I believe there was a British operative killed near Burn Beach, which is in the north west, only about a month ago. And there has been an inquiry, I believe, in Parliament as to how exactly he was killed. So, you know, it's very clear that there are, as you say, covert troops, boots on the ground, special forces on the ground. I have had reports from a number of areas that have been liberated that they've found not only British, but French, German, and US troops among the victims in the military campaigns to liberate specific areas. So it's very clear that Britain has been training groups on the ground and is on the ground inside Syria. I mean, we know now also that obviously France is being used to effectively colonise areas of Syria again on the basis that they're saying they're there to prevent the re-emergence of ISIS. Well, my suggestion would be right now Syria and Russia are liberating the south of Damascus, so the Yarmouk Palestinian suburb area and around that, from ISIS. So why is this alliance, the US, France and the UK, not collaborating with Syria and with the Russians and its allies in Iran and Hezbollah to defeat ISIS to the south of Damascus? You know, it's sheer hypocrisy, Tony. It's
good question. Finally, can you just... I did say finally before, but can you just give us a few pointers as to good places to go to actually, you know, go round the BBC's... I have to say, appalling programme, trending. I mean, clearly not trending with their journalists because they're just not really being followed by most of the people on social media. People aren't interested in listening to their lies. Whereabouts can people go other than Twitter? Are there any good news services around the world that we can follow what's happening there on?
I think, I mean, obviously I would put forward 21st Century Wire, UK Column, do a very good daily news programme covering events in Syria and elsewhere. The journalists that I would suggest following, because they write for various media outlets, are, for example, Sharmeen Nalwani, Eva Bartlett, Professor Tim Anderson. I would follow Professor Piers Robinson, who has set up the Syria Working Group to monitor the propaganda against Syria real-time, which is a very exciting development, actually, within academia, to have academics following and monitoring The level of propaganda that is being deployed against Syria actually as it's happening, rather than as academics tend to.
And another major journalist is Robert Fisk. He's been reporting very
Absolutely.
Critically and incredible. Here's somebody with more awards, more experience than almost any other British journalist, and he's simply being totally sidelined by all the major networks over here.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary. You know, Fisk has actually maintained a pretty middle ground line in Syria, but he went to Douma. He was one of the first Muslim journalists to enter. And he reported back what he saw and heard, which is what all honest journalists should be doing. And as you say, he's now being maligned for that because he simply, you know, he stepped out of the frame that most journalists have to work within.
Anyway, Vanessa Beely, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, Martin, what would you make of all of this?
Well, I mean, obviously, I follow Vanessa's work quite closely, and it was great to have her on. I mean, her analysis of what goes on over there is invaluable, and it's first-hand, on-the-ground journalism.
I mean, unlike
pontificating from a cosy study in academia.
Or the BBC World Service. Mm. I mean, it's absolutely appalling that they're putting forward this person who's so biased, Scott Lucas, as someone who's supposed to be objective. I mean, that's just a simple...
Well, he's directly linked... to organisations directly linked to the White Helmets.
It's a blatant lie. He's at Birmingham University, which is actually not far from Coventry, is it?
Why are we mentioning Coventry?
Well, because this is where James Le Mesurier is based.
Oh, was it? No, you're thinking of the Syrian Observation of Human Rights. That's the...
No, James Le Mesurier has got his office in Coventry.
Well, I know that the office of the Syrian Observatory of Human Rights, which is some guy in his bedroom, is based in Coventry.
Well,
so
maybe he's next door to James Le Mesurier.
Well, it wouldn't be surprising. I understood that Le Mesurier was actually based in Turkey when he set all this stuff up. But in any case, the idea that this is an independent, non-governmental organisation, in which is massive amounts of government money are channeled to it, I mean, the Swedish... Physicians for Human Rights have even suggested that they've actually murdered children for their videos. So there you go.
Now, on Dialect, coming up on Wednesday next week at noon, we're hoping very much to be able to bring it to you because there have been all sorts of technical problems the last 6 weeks. The technical team here at BCFM haven't been able to bring you Dialect, but I'm promised that this Wednesday it will be happening. You can get it online at dialectradio.co.uk. Did a fantastic, I thought, fascinating interview with Professor Alexander Azadgan, from California, and here is what he had to say about Qatar, because Vanessa mentioned them just now, maybe it wasn't Vanessa, it was the Syrian MP Fares Shahabi that mentioned them, but let's have a listen to what he had to say about Qatar now, and also some of the bigger geopolitical things that are going on in the Middle East.
We are transitioning from petroleum to natural gas. And Saudi Arabia is in the eighth, ranking. The first two are U.S., Russia, followed by Iran and Qatar, or Qatar and Iran. They sort of go back and forth. So they feel an existential threat when it comes to future income, future revenues, cash flow from their Iranian and Qatari counterparts. So we have that element to it. That's why they're threatened by Qatar, and they have their ridiculous 13-item
demands
to the Qataris. I mean, the first one is shut down Al Jazeera. I mean, they have no concept of the modern world and how media functions. And I believe second or third, somewhere in the very top, is sever all your relations with Iran. Qataris happen to share the world's largest natural gas field under the Persian Gulf with the Iranians. They're not going to sacrifice or create a bad blood with the Iranians, even though they're part of the GCC. And there is bad blood between them because Qatar supported the terrorists in northern Iraq and Syria. They supported these ISIS monsters. But they're changing. There's a change of policy, massive change of policy going on in Qatar.
I think fascinating some of this stuff to do with the changing nature, Martin, of energy. But what Alexander Azagon there, I suppose, is pointing out is that there's this whole list of demands that the Qataris are supposed to be obeying at the moment, including closing down Al Jazeera and severing all ties with Iran.
Well, the other thing that the Saudis were suggesting is they've got to send troops to northern Syria. And the Saudis are pushing for an invasion of northern Syria by Gulf Cooperation Council troops. And they want the Qataris to send their they've got about 6,000 soldiers in Qatar. It's only a small state. And, of course, what they really want is for those soldiers to be killed in Syria so that they can then absorb Qatar into Saudi Arabia. But that's where we're going. That's the next thing that's going to happen, is that the democratic states of Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates and Qatar are being bullied into line to invade Syria so that the Americans can go home. It's and almost, Trump can say he's got out of it.
These sorts of demands from one state onto another are almost unprecedented, aren't they? I mean, it does sound incredible. It's a bit like what we heard earlier from the Board of Deputies of British Jews telling the Labour Party, you're going to have an ombudsman. You know, actually, for one organisation saying to another, this is how you run things. This is, we're starting to get into a really quite a hostile area, and there doesn't seem to be any kind of real criticism by the mainstream press saying, well, actually, you can't tell that other country how to behave. You can't tell them what to do. I mean, what I'm suggesting here is, obviously not with the Labour Party and the Board of Deputies, but with Qatar and Saudi Arabia, is this could be a precursor to war.
Well, listen, if you're living in Syria, there already is a war. The idea that this war hasn't started is laughable. It's been going on since 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq, and it was going on before that if you lived in Argentina during the dictatorship. War has been going on for a long time, and we're getting to the point now where it could turn into a worldwide conflagration. The only thing preventing that is the common sense of the Russian political leadership and the professionalism of their military. Because if they were led by other lesser people, we'd already be well into it. But they've actually done everything they can to avoid it.
But this is really self-interest from the Russians. They can't afford to lose Syria and the bases in the eastern Mediterranean, can they?
No, well, they're not there because of the base at Tartarus. That's absurd. In actual fact, the US has got 130 bases all over the world. The Chinese have got one base outside China, which is in Djibouti, but they've only just opened. The fact of the matter is, the Russians are in Syria because if the Syrian regime had collapsed and a jihadi regime had been set up there, it would have become a base for attacks inside Russia to destabilise the Chinese attempts to build the One Belt, One Road infrastructure that they want to do. And ultimately, the Russians decided that they were going to fight in Syria because they didn't want to have to fight inside the Russia itself. So their deployment is entirely defensive, but as an entirely defensive deployment, they're not going to back down. Why would they?
As Vanessa talked there about false flags in Syria, there are a lot of people pushing for this kind of thing, and one of them is a chap called Patrick Clawson. He's employed in a US-Israeli think tank, a part of the Israel lobby, and he is suggesting that maybe a false flag would be a good idea to start a war with Iran. So let's have a listen to him now.
I frankly think that crisis initiation is really tough, and it's very hard for me to see how the United States president can get us to war with Iran. Which leads me to conclude that if, in fact, compromise is not coming, that the traditional way of America gets to war is what would be best for U.S. interests. Some people might think that Mr. Roosevelt wanted to get us into World War II, as David mentioned. You may recall we had to wait for Pearl Harbor. Some people might think Mr. Wilson wanted to get us into World War I. You may recall he had to wait for the Lusitania episode. Some people might think that Mr. Johnson wanted to send troops to Vietnam. You may recall they had to wait for the Gulf of Tonkin episode. We didn't go to war with Spain until the USS, until the Maine exploded. And may I point out that Mr. Lincoln did not feel he could call out the Federal Army until Fort Sumter was attacked, which is why he ordered the commander at Fort Sumter to do exactly that thing which the South Carolinians had said would cause an attack. So if, in fact, the Iranians aren't going to compromise, it would be best if somebody else started the war. One can combine other means of pressure with sanctions. I mentioned that explosion on August 17th. We could step up the pressure. I mean, look, people, Iranian submarines periodically go down. Someday one of them might not come up. Who would know why? We can do a variety of things if we wish to increase the pressure. I'm not advocating that. But I'm just suggesting that this is not a either-or proposition. It's just sanctions has to succeed or other things. We are in the game of using covert means against the Iranians. We could get nastier at that.
Well, you know, when they're talking amongst themselves, they speak the truth. They're in the game of using covert means against the Iranians. Well, it couldn't be clearer, could it? They want a war. They're looking for a war. They're looking to provoke a war.
What about
when they get one, they might not like it.
What about the list he gave there? Pearl Harbor, the sinking of the Lusitania, the Gulf of Tonkin, the sinking of the ship the Maine, and also Fort Sumter in the American Civil War.
All right, well, I mean, it's hard to bracket all. All of them were casus belli, if you like, but let's just pick on one, the Gulf of Tonkin incident. All the evidence suggests that it was a fabricated incident, fabricated by the US in order to create a casus belli against North Vietnam.
What about Pearl Harbor?
Pearl Harbor, there's a long, big literature about that, and it's quite clear that the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor because they felt they had no option because Roosevelt had cut them off from oil supplies and so on, and he needed them to attack Pearl Harbor so that he could then have a war against Germany, as it turned out to be.
I mean, the Americans pretended, didn't they? They didn't know that the ship...
They cracked the Japanese naval codes and they knew what they were going to do.
What about the Lusitania?
Well, the Lusitania was actually carrying war materiel across the Atlantic to help the Allies against the Germans. And the Germans were foolish to sink it, but they did because they knew it was actually carrying war materiel. Now, in actual fact, each of those incidents is actually separate, so you can't just put them all in together. But I think mentioning both the Gulf of Tonkin, I think that is the incident. The Gulf of Tonkin incident never took place. It was a bit like the Douma chemical weapons attack. Nothing happened. It was actually leveraged into, oh my goodness me, the North Koreans have attacked us with a speedboat. And on that basis, the United States went to war with North Vietnam. But of course, what I'd like to remind them is they lost. So you can start wars, but you can't necessarily finish them. If they go to war with Iran, they're going to lose their whole navy in the Gulf in the first half hour. That's what's going to happen. They're going to lose. They're fools.
Okay, now let's mention briefly the Zadists over in France taking on everything President Macron stands for. So we've got 7,000 people joining the squatters near Nantes in western France to defend their buildings from 2,500 riot police. Now, this is a vast area of land, many acres in France, and it's basically a kind of permaculture community, mostly lefties, who are living there, actually building things, Martin, growing food, all that sort of thing. Apparently it's government land, and the authorities have decided that the whole thing has got to be bulldozed.
Well, this is the first I've heard of this, so I'll be interested to hear what comes of it. I mean, in France, there's a great tradition of contestation, where people, you know, resist the state. You know, farmers turn up and tip all of their vegetables all over the local town hall. Protesters protest. It's a great French tradition, and long may it continue.
This latest reports on this whole confrontation are from around about a week ago or so. The muddy and bloody battle in the fields of western France. This is in the local France paper. Tear gas, petrol bombs, as French police clear what they call it an eco camp, and that's the Guardian on the 10th of April. But Martin, this is the sort of confrontation that you kind of was almost inevitable with the Macron government. They don't really seem to be all that. They're apparently anti-airport protesters, many of them, a bit like the camp that was there called Grow Heathrow.
Yeah, or the people who protested against Narita Airport in Tokyo. Now, I don't know...
But much bigger scale. We're talking about 5,000 people.
It's all right. Well, I mean, this is the first I've heard of it, so I don't really know the ins and outs of it. But the fact of the matter is Macron is not popular. He only got elected because the left voted for him to keep out Marine Le Pen. And they didn't vote for him, they voted against her. So his actual level of support is actually quite
weak. He came out of nowhere, didn't he? Actually, he's a former Rothschild bank employee.
Indeed. Basically, he rescued France from Marine Le Pen, but he was only able to do that because the left voted for him to keep her out, because he was in the second round, he was the one that made it to the second round. But of course, in actual fact, the left in France despise Macron, and ultimately the left will win, I think, in France, because historically they always have, and Macron will go the way of other puppets before him.
But he's there for another few years still, isn't he?
He is, but I don't think he's attacking these people and having a confrontation with them is not going to do him any good at all.
Another thing which rather worries me about the way France is going is he's trying now to seize the bank accounts of all the mosques in France. Now, this might sound like take government control over the bank accounts of the mosques. Now, this has echoes of what Hitler was doing in the early 30s to the Jewish community, which was beginning to seize control of their finances.
Well, the other thing, of course, is that it was shown with Mohammed bin Salman, the dictator of Saudi Arabia, was shown with his arm round Macron. And Macron's a great fan of Saudi Arabia, who in actual fact are the big funders of jihadi propaganda, both in France and Britain. The obvious thing to do is stop the Saudis funding mosques. Don't bother to close down all the mosques, just stop the Saudis spending any money on mosques, because they're a dictatorship, and they use that money to try and bend simple minds
It might sound like a stupid question, but why doesn't Macron simply do that?
Because in actual fact, this is a means of social control over people who disagree with his policy. If they were serious about crushing jihadi terrorism, they would... basically, we shouldn't have gone to war with Afghanistan, we should have gone to war with Saudi Arabia. But far from going to war with Saudi Arabia, we actually support Saudi Arabia. And as we've been hearing in the early part of the programme, the White Helmets and all these other organisations embedded with Al-Qaeda, we train those people. The SAS are training jihadi Al-Qaeda terrorists as we speak. And of course in Yemen, the Saudis are bombing and killing, creating the biggest humanitarian catastrophe on the planet, according to the UN, including a major cholera outbreak. British military personnel are helping them do that.
Okay.
I think it's time for a war, don't you, Tony? Time for a real war.
No, I don't think so. No, I don't.
No, I'm just mocking their stupid rhetoric. They claim to want war, and ultimately, the only thing that stops dogs that bark at buses is when they catch one.
Now let's talk about Anna Politkovskaya, because I was rather concerned to see a lot of talk about Putin killed this journalist. So looking a little bit deeper into her story, she died around about October 2006. Well, she didn't die. She was shot dead in her tower block as she was in one of the lifts by a guy in a baseball cap. It seemed to be some kind of contract killing. Now, is that the sort of thing that Putin might have done? Because she was writing some very articles, very critical of Putin back then, Martin.
Well, I have to tell you, I used to go to Russia in the 1990s, and lots of people were being killed, particularly journalists. Anybody who got any information, you could tread on somebody's toes just like that. And at one stage in Kiev, for example, it cost about $400 to get somebody killed. That's not always necessarily the state.
Well,
and I had a run-in with those kind of people when I was over there.
She was killed on Putin's birthday, apparently. And she was the journalist
who... Oh, well, he must be guilty then.
She was the journalist who published three different articles on how someone was testing polonium on Chechen children. So where have we seen that scenario before, says an article I was reading about Remember Anna Politkovskaya. So Anna's lawyer, Stanislav Markolov, was also murdered in 2009, followed by the murder of one of the key informants of the in Chechnya, Natalie Estonirova, the same year. So there's been a whole load of other murders after this. Actually, there were a lot of prosecutions as well, which we haven't really heard about, and they were of FSB agents who'd been following her in Moscow and following her down in Chechnya. And it turned out that they'd been taking money from the Chechen mafia.
Well, in actual fact, if you think about the murder of Boris Nemtsov, the Moscow police did a fantastic job of catching everybody involved with that, and they were all sent to prison. But, of course, we're told that Russia is a lawless state. It was a lawless state. It still is to some extent, but not nearly as lawless as the United States of America or Britain.
Now, the killers, it seems, were actually possibly being possibly paid by Boris Berezovsky. Would that make any sense?
Well, that would, because Berezovsky got Samuel Basiev to invade Dagestan as part of his strategy to prevent the communists winning the 1998 election.
Anyway, I'll put some links up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 8 o'clock. Thanks to our guests, Tim Bowles and Eleanor Cumley. He's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show...
You know, a depression broke out in 1873, just when Twain published his Gilded Age book, and it continued for four long, miserable years, and there was mass unemployment all over the country and mass evictions and so on, and that was particularly the case in New York City. Demonstrators gathered in Tompkins Square, which is on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and that demonstration was met with violence by the city police force, and forever after Tompkins Square, all during the Gilded Age, would be remembered as one of those critical moments of class confrontation which characterized the era.
I would think Tompkins Square would be a fine example of your point. Today, it's still there. It's a very popular park, but it's more like a doggy park today.
It is. And I think the striking thing, you know, it's very hard for us living in the times we live in today, acquiescent times, if you will, to imagine what life was like 100 or 125 years ago.
Today, a conversation comparing and contrasting the Gilded Age between 1870 and the early 1900s and the so-called Second Gilded Age, which we're living through today. Our guest is Steve Frazier, a labor historian and author of the book The Age of Acquiescence, The Life and Death of American Resistance to Organize Wealth and Power. That's next on Letters and Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. Donald Trump says it's disgraceful that a list of questions that the special counsel investigating Russian election interference wants to ask him was leaked to the news media. The New York Times published the nearly four dozen questions given to Trump's attorneys covering Trump's motivations for firing FBI Director James Comey last May and contacts between Trump campaign officials and Russians. Trump also tweeted, quote, "No questions on collusion. Oh, I see. You have made up phony crime collusion that never existed. and an investigation begun with illegally classified information. Nice, Trump tweeted. But the questions do appear to indicate that Robert Mueller's team is looking into possible collusion, some touch on Russian meddling, and whether the Trump campaign coordinated in any way with the Kremlin. May Day protests and marches for labor and immigrants' rights take place around the country today. In Tijuana, Mexico, a caravan of Central American asylum seekers spent a second night outdoors waiting for a chance to make their claims to border agents. Eight of the approximately 140 caravan members were given the opportunity. U.S. authorities may separate some parents from their children and detain them for months while their asylum cases are pending. This mother of three said she fled Honduras because her life and that of her children were at risk.
I decided to join the caravan because I didn't have another option. The people who are chasing after me found me in Tapachula. Staying in Mexico is not an option. I need to be helped for Donald Trump to listen to me. I can't return to Honduras because I'll be killed together with my children. My children are an easy prey for the gangs, and I don't want that.
The Justice Department said it filed illegal entry charges against 11 people it identified as caravan members. There was no immediate confirmation that claim of their identity was accurate. Thousands of Puerto Ricans are marching to protest pension cuts, school closures, and slow hurricane recovery efforts as anger grows across the island over looming austerity measures. The protest attracted teachers, retirees, and unionized workers from both the private and public sectors. The mayor of the capital, San Juan, Carmen Yulín Cruz, was among those marching. More than 7 months after Hurricane Maria, some 30,000 customers remain in the dark without power. White House Chief of Staff John Kelly is dismissing as total BS a report that he has referred to Trump as an idiot. On one occasion, Kelly reportedly worried that Trump would make a deal for the undocumented young immigrants known as Dreamers that wouldn't be harsh enough on immigration. NBC reported two sources saying that Kelly derided Trump, saying, quote, he doesn't even understand what DACA is. He's an idiot. After the NBC report aired, Trump went on Twitter to accuse what he calls the fake news of making up false stories and using unnamed sources he says don't exist. Trump also said the White House is running very smoothly. Former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was similarly reported as having called Trump a moron. Trump fired Tillerson via Twitter in March. Attorneys representing thousands of former students of the now bankrupt Corinthian colleges were in federal court to restore an Obama-era loan forgiveness program. The Trump administration canceled the program and replaced it with a new formula, giving students partial relief based on income. Eileen Connor is an attorney with the Project on Predatory Student Lending. The organization seeks relief for students defrauded by for-profit colleges.
Even when people take advantage of programs like income-based repayment, where they earn so little that they're able to make a $0 payment and be considered in good standing on their loans, it's not curing the difficulty that people are in because the loans are still on their credit reports. There's a psychological impact of having debt, especially when it's the product of an illegitimate school. All of those harms aren't really resolved by income-based repayment.
At its height, Corinthian operated more than 100 campuses in 25 states and enrolled 110,000 students. It collected $1.7 billion in federal student aid. Corinthian folded in 2015 after the Education Department cut off its access to federal aid after determining Corinthian lied about student graduation and job placement rates. I'm Eileen Alfandary. Letters and Politics is next.
Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jesrich, and as we begin today's program, I'd like to wish you a very happy Law Day. That's right, Law Day. In 1958, President Dwight D. Eisenhower officially proclaimed that May 1st would be a day dedicated to reflecting on the importance of the rule of law, being again May 1st. Now, some of you may be saying, wait 1 minute, Mitch Jesrich, today is May Day, International Workers' Day. And of course, there'll be others of you who also point out that today is an important pagan springtime holiday. And for those of you, allow me to say, may your cattle find happy pastures. But let's focus on International Workers' Day, which is marked around the world today. And here, too, thanks to immigrants, really beginning back in 2006, who helped put it back on the map. And why, officially, it's still Law Day. Now, International Workers' Day has its roots in the United States, and the 1886 so-called Haymarket Square affair or incident or even massacre. Now, on May 1st, 1886, a general strike began in Chicago demanding an eight-hour workday. An unidentified person set off a bomb at Haymarket Square on May 4th, and then police responded by firing into the crowd, killing and injuring scores of people. Well, of course, a riot ensued, and then eight police officers were also killed. In response to the killing of the police officers, the labor leaders of the general strike were then rounded up and tried in what has been described as a sham court proceeding. Four of those labor leaders were sentenced to death, and on November 11, 1887, Samuel Fielden, Adolf Fischer, August Spies, and Albert Parsons were executed. Now, just a few years later, the Second Internationale, in response to all this, proclaimed then May 1st to be International Workers' Day, and that labor, socialist, anarchist, communist, leftist organizations should use this day to demand better conditions in the workplace and remember that, and to remember the Haymarket Affair. In fact, in the United States, like other places in the world, it became a holiday marking May Day, so it was recognized here until, that is, the Russian Revolution and the onset of the Cold War. Just after the Russian Revolution, a few years after, the veterans of foreign wars here in the United States advocated May Day to be changed to Americanization Day. And then in 1949, Americanization Day was renamed to Loyalty Day. And then in 1958, Dwight D. Eisenhower called it Law Day. So that's how it became a, really, I think, a counter revolutionary slogan that is officially recognized in the law code of the United States. Well, with the spirit of the original May Day, and maybe not as original as the pagan time, but original of the labor portion of it, today we are going to be in conversation about the history of the struggle in the United States between labor and the capital class. I spoke to Steve Frazier. Steve Frazier is a labor historian, and he is the author of the book, Age of Acquiescence. Steve Frazier, it's my good pleasure to welcome you to this program.
Thanks. It's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
As we begin, let's talk about the term Gilded Age itself and what it means. And it was first coined, wasn't it, by Mark Twain in a book called The Gilded Age?
That's correct. It's Mark Twain's first bestseller, published in 1873, and that's where we get that that rubric from. It's still today a hilariously funny book, which makes fun of what today we would call the crony capitalism of that era. That is to say, the kind of incestuous relationship between big business back then, which meant big railroads and mining companies and banks, and the government, and the roster of corrupt politicians ranged all the way from the vice president through the Senate, all through the Congress, into the cabinets of the presidents who ran things in those days. Twain meant it to mean both crony capitalism and the kind of obsession with wealth, with what clerics of that age might have called mammon worship, the way it corrupted not only corrupted democracy and undermined the egalitarian ethos that America was supposed to be dedicated to. So that's where we get that term from.
Mark Twain, considered the great American writer, he came up with many terms in that book that we'd still use today, especially if we're despairingly talking about big money.
Yes, absolutely. The era was characterized by one scandal after another, which implicated the highest officials in taking kickbacks and bribes and providing tax exemptions and free land and so on, especially for the great railroad corporations of that day. And a lot of Twain's book has to do with that, and with the kind of confidence man
capitalism that characterized the era. There were a lot of scams of the sort that we became familiar with during the subprime debacle of our own more recent past. The Senate back in those days was known, this is in the late 19th century, was known as the Millionaires Club, and many people felt it represented not people but corporations. In those days, that might have been a General Electric or the Pennsylvania Railroad or the newly born United States Steel. And moreover, the judicial system was considered utterly, especially the federal judiciary, not the state judiciary, at the mercy of and in the pay of the corporate behemoths of that age.
I'm just taking this from your book, the introduction of your book, but some of those terms include robber barons, how the other half lives, cross of gold, conspicuous consumption, the leisure class, other people's money, social Darwinism, and the survival of the fittest. Gay 90s. What did that mean, gay 90s?
Yeah, all of that language was kind of part of the lingua franca of America. It wasn't invented by Twain. I thought you were asking me about language he had invented. Most of that, except for the Gilded Age, is invented by a variety of other people. The gay 90s meant this kind of extravagant flaunting of great wealth by that era's one, what today we would call the 1%, and a kind of callous indifference to the lot of most Americans in that day, the poverty, the exploitation, the urban squalor, that the sweatshop working conditions that most of them faced. For the 1%, for Thorsten Veblen's leisure class, none of that mattered. Instead, what mattered was parading their wealth and faux genealogies, which presumably linked them back to all kinds of noble families. There's a phenomenon known in that day as the dollar princess, where American nouveau riche were kind of auctioning off their daughters to bankrupted European nobility, the second, third, and fourth sons of British and French and other aristocratic families, in order to buy the social credentials which they otherwise lacked. And they would go to these balls, they would stage these masked balls, these masquerade balls, and dress up like Henry VIII or Louis XIV. Or Marie Antoinette, all the while surrounded in cities like New York and Chicago and elsewhere by mass destitution, poverty, actual starvation in the streets during the Great Depressions of that era in the 1870s and the 1890s. But they were enjoying what we have come down to us as the gay 90s.
And yes, an accurate reading of your introduction does say that's the popular vernacular during this time. Steve Frazier, you spend a lot of time in your book, The Age of Acquiescence, talking about the opposition to all of this wealth accumulation and division within society. And something I learned in your book from going through it was about the 1877 railroad insurrection. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. In 1877, a strike of railroad workers, which began on the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, actually in Gaithersburg, Maryland, spread all over the country from coast to coast, paralyzed cities, industries. It became a general strike in St. Louis. There was a near general strike in San Francisco. There was the mobilization of federal and state militias to combat not only the striking railroad workers, but all of their multiple allies. That is, the whole of rural and small town America turned out in support of the railroad strikers. I should add that this was happening, the strike, amidst what at that point was the worst depression the country had ever experienced. It was an enormously violent confrontation. Not only were strikers shot down in considerable numbers, wounded or killed, but there was enormous property damage. Railroad properties were seized, burned, freight cars, locomotives. This was a member memorable event, which actually began in July of that year, which would never be forgotten by that generation of Americans. And in part, it would never be forgotten because it was repeated again and again and again all through that first Gilded Age in a series, a rolling series of great strikes that paralyzed the steel industry, that erupted in coal mines, both on the East Coast and out west, hit the meatpacking industry, that became a general movement for the eight-hour day in the mid-1880s. So that insurrection set off a series of insurrections which characterized the first Gilded Age. And if I may go on, or you may want me to stop, but if I...
No, please. We'd like to give people time to really explain what they're saying.
You know, one of the reasons I set out to write this book is because although these two Gilded Ages, our own and the one back then, share a lot of similarities, they are very different. And one of the principal ways they're different, and the reason the book is entitled the way it is entitled, is that back then, this massive resistance to organize wealth and power, both by working people and farmers and middle class people, was very common and robust and had profound effect on the political life of the country. That has not been the case, by and large, in our own more recent Gilded Age, or what I call the Age of Acquiescence.
There were fears in 1877 with the railroad insurrection that this could spark a new civil war. Of course, we're only 12 years since the previous Civil War.
Yes, that's right. Only 12 years since the bloodiest, most traumatic moment in American history, and people were already talking about, and this was commonplace talk, about a second Civil War between the haves and the have-nots, which was personified in that 1877 insurrection on the railroads. That is to say, people were shocked at how divisive the country had become, how the level of inequality, the distribution of wealth and income had widened so dramatically, how democracy had become so powerless to stop this inequality from going on, how brutal the response was to the demand for such simple things as the eight-hour day or a simple wage increase, which is the way that great insurrection began. The workers were simply asking not really for a wage increase, just to stop a cut in wages, which the railroad corporations were demanding. So people talk commonly about a second civil war. The Paris Commune had just happened in France, and there were nightmare visions by the business classes and the upper middle class that the Commune would come to America, that there would be riots in the streets, that there would be a kind of seizing of private property, that there'd be free love, communal ways of, in other words, it became a kind of mass hysteria that swept parts of the country.
Did the Paris Commune become influential?
Right before this insurrection, the Paris Commune happens in 1870-71. It alarms the whole Western world. It's a failed instance of a kind of workers' republic that breaks out in Paris after the Franco-Prussian War, which is put down very violently. But during the course of that 3 or 4 month commune, it raised the specter in the minds of the upper classes of that kind of class warfare spreading to America, because people well knew, and I'm not talking now just about radicals, presidents, journalists, clerics, novelists, poets, all were observing this widening social division in the country and feared what it might bring in its wake. And the insurrection in 1873, and actually a riot in Tompkins Square in New York in 1874, and numerous events like that made this seem a real palpable possibility that there would soon be the second civil war.
Tompkins Square and the Lower East Side of Manhattan. What was the riot in 1874 in Tompkins Square about?
It was about the Depression. You know, a depression broke out in 1873, just when Twain published his Gilded Age book, and it continued for 4 long miserable years, and there was mass unemployment all over the country and mass evictions and so on, and that was particularly the case in New York City. Demonstrators gathered in Tompkins Square, which is on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, demanding relief, public work, public works, to put them back to work, and were quite militant about it, and threatened to march on Wall Street, which they picked out as a center of power and of indifference to the plight of working people. And that demonstration was met with violence by the city police force, and who dispersed the crowd quite violently. And forever after, Tompkins Square, all during the Gilded Age, would be remembered as one of those critical moments of class confrontation which characterized the era.
I would think Tompkins Square would be a fine example of your point in your book, The Age of Acquiescence. Here, it's this hotbed of protest during the late 1800s. Today, it's still there. It's a very popular park, but it's more like a doggy park today.
It is. And I think the striking thing, you know, it's very hard for us living in the times we live in today, acquiescent times, if you will, to imagine what life was like 100 or 125 years ago. But let me give you an example of how fraught relations were. It was a commonplace in major metropolitan centers in this country for worker militias to march through the streets of those cities armed, in order to notify their opponents, that is the business classes of these cities, that if attacked, they were prepared to fight back. Can you imagine such a thing today? Well, no, nobody can. And that's an extreme example. And one would hardly recommend that we march around armed, ready to fight each other and, you know, shoot down each other. Nonetheless, it's indicative of how prepared people were to confront this new menace, which was industrial capitalism.
And that's an important aspect here. You say one of the reasons, and you're right, that one of the reasons why we have really militant actions in the late 1800s, early 1900s as well, and we're talking actions by all kinds of people, including socialists, the influence of anarchism, which perhaps we could talk about in a moment. But you're right, one of the main differences between then and now is then people were experiencing a drastic change to their daily lives, especially in the realm of economics.
Yes, that's well put. That's right. What we have is, you know, we take for granted capitalism, industrial and finance capitalism, as if it's an inevitability and a fate, and there's no other way to organize society and the economy. People didn't think that 100, 150 years ago because they came from very different ways of life. They were handicraftsmen. They were independent farmers. They were peasants migrating from southern Europe. They were small businessmen in operating in small local markets in towns all across the country. They were skilled artisans. In other words, they were not wage laborers. They might be for the first time experiencing the hardships and exploitation associated with 19th century wage labor. But they knew that was not the only way that society could be organized. They knew, for example, that their economies had once not been dominated by the cold calculus of profit and loss, the calculus of the marketplace, that there had been a kind of moral economy which believed in just prices and just wages and one highly regulated by the communal needs of local society. For all of these reasons, they were threatened with a kind of existential extinction by industrial capitalism. They were being transformed into proletarians, a word we don't use today, or wage slaves, a word we don't use today, but was commonly used then. And it meant that they were going out of existence in a way, it kind of identity politics of the first Gilded Age. They were going out of existence as independent, self-reliant people, whether they were handicraftsmen or farmers or whatever they were, and they knew that didn't have to be. And it gave them the imagination, the courage, the audacity to resist something that was new. And it's only when we get to the mid and late 20th century that memory and those roots and those kinds of ways of alternative ways of organizing society seem to have vanished. So that back then you have not only this labor movement we've been talking about. You have the populist movement, which talks about establishing a cooperative commonwealth, an anti-capitalist cooperative commonwealth. You have the socialist movement, which you alluded to, and the anarchist movement, which envision, obviously, a kind of socialist collective ownership of the means of production in a new way of organizing society. You have the anti-monopoly movement. The anti-monopoly movement enlisted millions, not only of small businessmen, but also of consumers and working people who imagined not only breaking up the trust, the antitrust movement was a big deal back in the late 19th century, but also of public ownership of vital public resources, utilities, transportation networks, the things that we, even banks that we all depend on. The anti-monopoly movement envisioned that as well. So you had all these kinds of alternatives, which it gave people something to fight for beyond capitalism. Even if it was not necessarily socialism, it was something other than capitalism, and it provided the kind of intellectual and imaginative and emotional wherewithal to fight back.
We're talking about a changing economy, a changing world. This reminds me of the story of the Luddites in England. Today we use the term Luddite as a derogatory towards somebody who may be uncomfortable with technology. But actually, the Luddites, yeah, they destroyed the machines, but it was because the machines were displacing their value for work and bringing just more profit to the top. Most people don't know that about that term.
Exactly right. Take the populace, for example. A lot of people used to dismiss them as, you know, they wanted to go back to some golden Jeffersonian age of the yeoman farmer. That's actually not the case. They welcomed modern technology. They welcomed the wealth that modern technology helped to create. They actually advocated long before it became a middle class obsession, things like the income tax, the progressive income tax, public ownership of utilities and the transportation network. In other words, they weren't trying to go backward in time. They were trying to figure out a way to preserve their self-respect and dignity, which also looked forward to a kind of more modern society, not one that was simply reacting to change in a negative sense.
Again, we are in conversation with Steve Frazier. Steve Frazier is a labor historian, award-winning author, author of a number of books about the history of labor. His latest, what we are in conversation about, is called The Age of Acquiescence, The Life and Death of American Resistance to Organized Wealth and Power. Steve Frazier, when we talk about the differences then between the First Gilded Age and the Second Gilded Age, and just before the First Gilded Age, as you have this really changing world, I guess as we look at the differences, in one sense, it doesn't seem all that different. Now we have a new economic age based on financialization. We have just this explosion in technology that is uprooting all kinds of people's previous form of work, including yours and ours, who works in media and publishing.
Yeah, well, that's true. There are a lot of similarities. People who say, look, this is the same old, it's deja vu all over again, have a point. That is to say, there is the same gross maldistribution of income and wealth. There's the same kind of obnoxious, extravagant flaunting of great wealth. There's the same kind of social Darwinian callousness. Today, if you don't make it big, you're a loser. Then you are a kind of casualty of survival of the fittest. There is the same kind of crony capitalism or corruption in politics. There's the same undermining of all the democratic institutions that are supposed to protect the people against the powerful and the wealthy. These things are all similar. There's no question about that. But there are these striking differences. One, of course, is what we've been talking about, the extent of resistance, which is far, far less in our own age. A second is this lack of a kind of alternative vision or set of visions of what might replace a system which has shown itself in the last 30 or 40 years to be kind of heading back to the future. That is to say, we now have an economy which more and more is characterized by sweatshop labor. 30 to 40 million people work full-time today and make less than poverty-level wages. That's a scandal. The sweatshop back around the year 1900 was considered an aberration, a kind of noxious departure from capitalism. Now it's increasingly, in the age of neoliberal flexible capitalism, considered the norm. Also, in our second Gilded Age, we are experiencing a developed country, that is to say the United States, undergoing a process of underdevelopment. That is to say, the general standard of living has either stagnated or declined for millions of people over the last 30 or 40 years, despite the gaiety that that is common in the precincts of the 1%. During the first Gilded Age, brutal and as exploitative as it was, there was instead a slow, gradual uptick in the standard of living for most people.
But wasn't the standard then so low? You didn't have labor protections that you have today. You didn't have anti-child labor laws.
Well, that's true. But what we have today is the defanging of all of those protections, the stripping away of all the welfare state provisions. The National Labor Relations Act has become a joke. Nobody obeys it, and no corporation obeys it anymore. The chances of getting a free and fair election at a work site are minimal. The law is used by corporate America to delay interminably the resolution of grievances or demands about to engage in collective bargaining until workers who have no choice give up, go elsewhere, work elsewhere. There are millions of low-wage workers in this country today, and there are numerous reports that document this, that are working at wage levels for hours and without health and safety benefits that are proscribed by law. But business in America today uniformly, or if not uniformly, widely ignores that law because there's no enforcement mechanism in place. All of the social welfare provisions that you're referring to was the culmination of the resistance to that first Gilded Age.
Not just the New Deal.
Yeah, which were created during the New Deal, have been slowly and more rapidly whittled away.
But you're saying though that these protections that really sort of came in the 1930s, this is part of what, a 60-year effort, all the way, 50-year effort,
yes,
all the way going back to the 1870s?
Yes, some of it, like, for instance, anti-sweatshop legislation begins to emerge around the turn of the century, long before the Great Depression and the New Deal. Safety legislation begins to emerge. States begin to pass minimum wage and maximum hour laws. All of that is, in my view, a function of this upwelling of resistance, which had characterized the country and alarmed so many people for decades by that point. Moreover, when you get to the 30s and you face what I guess arguably is the second most traumatic moment in American history, the Great Depression, you don't have only a president who's open to the possibility of significant reform. You have a population which is ready to demand it in a variety of ways, so that there are mass strikes all over the country. There's a San Francisco general strike. There's a Minneapolis general strike. There's a textile strike, which puts 450,000 textile workers on the picket line. There are sit-down strikes in the auto industry, in the rubber industry, in department stores, in the meatpacking industry. You have farmer labor parties emerging all through the Midwest and even in New York State. You have mass unemployment demonstrations, some of them met with violence, say in the case of the Ford Motor Company in 1932. You have movements to forcibly stop evictions, both from farms and from people's apartments at home. You have people actually seizing idled utility plants and coal mines, that is transgressing the holy of all holies, private property, and starting them up themselves so that they can survive. So there's a general atmosphere of anti-capitalism which fuels the political, which informs the political atmosphere of that moment and makes the New Deal reforms possible. The New Deal is not a function of a kind-hearted Hudson River patroon, which is what Roosevelt was, feeling.
And it's not just a reaction.
Feeling the pain.
And it's not just a reaction to, which I think a lot of people think it is, to the 1929 crash.
No, it's not, and it draws on this long reservoir of anti-capitalism. You know, anti-capitalism. There was a cultural persuasion, if you will, that says we are willing to say there might be something fundamentally wrong with capitalism. Now, what happens in the New Deal is capitalism doesn't go away, but it gets civilized, and that's. The kind of those that's where we get the set of reforms, protections that you alluded to. And that's an enormous accomplishment. It makes it possible to live even under the regime of wage labor in a civilized way. And what we've experienced in the second Gilded Age is the stripping away of all that civilized infrastructure so that increasingly people are downwardly mobile, working in sweatshops, without the kinds of protections, for example, that the union movement provided, deindustrialized. You know, the first Gilded Age was characterized by the industrial upbuilding of the country. Our Gilded Age has been characterized by the denuding of the tangible wealth of the country, deindustrial, turning industrial cities into ghost towns, and whittling away at the standard of living, which was won with such pain during that first Gilded Age and during the New Deal era.
Tell me about the insurrections of 1893 and 1894, in which around 40 armies all together were formed, not government armies, but people's armies were formed all across the country with the goal to march on Washington. And the most well-known of these armies was called the Coxey's Army.
Yes. Yeah, this is a good example of the difference between the two ages. The 1890s experienced the worst depression in the country's history until you get to the Great Depression of 1929 and the 30s. And so what happened was there were masses of unemployed people all over the country. And the spirit of resistance was so powerful then that thousands and thousands of them massed themselves as unemployed armies and decided to march on Washington to demand relief, public works, a cheap credit, and so on. The most famous is Coxey's Army, which began out west. He was a kind of businessman. You know, he was a small businessman and a serious religious person who believed in the populist movement of free silver in order to re-energize the economy. And he and thousands of others made their way east across the country, moving through towns and cities, picking up adherents on their way to Washington. Some of these armies, and as you mentioned, there were 40 of them, actually seized railroad trains and in order to get to Washington faster. And in fact, at one point, one of the railroad companies whose train had been seized by one of these armies of the unemployed actually threatened to run a locomotive down the track in the opposite direction so as to destroy this train of the unemployed. Coxey finally made it to Washington, but Grover Cleveland, who was president at that time, had no interest in acceding to any of these demands. He said it wasn't the government's business to help out people in distress. They needed to fend for themselves.
Now, some of these armies, many of these armies, most of these armies, perhaps, besides Coxey's, you'll correct me if I'm wrong on this, never made it to Washington. Many of them were violently suppressed.
That's correct. Most of them did not make it to Washington. And as I say, violence was a commonplace. You know, during this first Gilded Age, I don't know out west whether people are familiar with this, but all through the East and Midwest, what happens in the mid-1870s, 80s, and 90s is you get the creation of what are today called armories. They're great fortress-like installations in the middle of big cities. Those armories were not built to defend the country against some foreign invader. They were built during these great insurrections so that there would be a way of shooting down the prospective Red Army of insurgent workers. And they were staffed often by the offspring of the wealthy, so that the Silk Stocking Regiment in New York City is made up of the sons of the super rich who train and drill and these fortresses are mounted with Gatling machine guns. This is serious business. They meant to deal violently with this feared insurrection. And so violence, whether it was dispersing armies of the unemployed or shooting down striking steel workers at Carnegie Steelworks in 1892, or federal troops confronting striking Pullman car workers all across the country during the strike of 1894, all of this was a common feature of American life. Fortunately, it no longer is. But what is also no longer the case is you don't have those great strikes and insurrection.
You have unions now. And, of course, it's through these fights that we're talking about through the first Gilded Age that we eventually get to legal unions. Do you think that could be part of the reason?
Yes, it is part of the reason. The unions were born out of strife and sometimes violent strife and then provided the kinds of protections that workers had been struggling for years. We don't have them anymore. You say we do, but we don't. Less than 7%.
I mean, we have legal unions, but
we have yes. We have legal. Yes, it's very legal. Except try and form one. Try and form one, and you will be met by the concerted resistance of a corporation you're trying to organize. Its whole armada of legal firms, a deaf and dumb Congress that does nothing to enforce the National Labor Relations Act. So yes, nominally, theoretically, it is legal to form unions, and it didn't entirely used to be. But in practice, it has long since ceased to be, practically speaking, a right to organize that you can't exercise, or that you exercise at great, great peril, much like was the case back 100, 150 years ago. And this is, documented over and over again by studies of labor relations in America today. So that the percent in 1955, roughly, more than a third of the private sector workforce in America belong to unions. And not only is that a very high percentage, but you need to understand that when that's the case, the part of the labor force that is not organized into unions enjoys nonetheless enormous leverage, because corporations will give them the kinds of wages and benefits and vacations and pensions and health care that their union competitors are providing in order to keep the union out, right? So really 33 or 35% is actually a more significant number than it might seem. Today, less than 7% of the private sector workforce is organized. That in part is a function of a kind of organized political antipathy to unions, and also a function of deindustrialization, which is the great legacy of the financialization that's characterized the Second Gilded Age.
Again, we are in conversation with Steve Frazier. Steve Frazier is a labor historian and author. He has written many books on the history of labor. His latest is called The Age of Acquiescence, The Life and Death of American Resistance to Organize Wealth and Power. Steve Frazier, as we talk about the activism and insurrections even that are happening during the First Gilded Age. This is also during a period that we know as Reconstruction after the Civil War, which is also referred to as the nadir of race relations. How did race play into this?
Well, it's very interesting. A race, of course, has been used and has functioned again and again as a divisive force within the working class movement, and not just among workers, but also among rebellious farmers of that age, of the populist movement. Again and again, the race card was played both by kind of Bourbon landlords in the South to keep poor white workers divided from their counterparts among African Americans in the South. And of course, it's used over and over again in all these industrial confrontations. So, for example, during the great steel strike of 1919, the race card is played by United States Steel and Youngstown Sheet and Tube and Inland Steel. All the great steel corporations use the race card, and they import African American scabs, or try to break the strike. And so that is one of the great Achilles heels of American in the history of American popular resistance to organized wealth. But I want to make this point. During this first Gilded Age, that very difficult hurdle was in fact successfully at times solved. During the great mass strikes of this era, in which whole communities, not particular groups of workers, but like all of Chicago, I don't mean all of Chicago, but small businessmen, small shopkeepers, workers in the meatpacking plants, workers at International Harvester, all kinds of artisans and handicraftsmen in various industries, jointly support each other's demands. And there were no barriers, not of gender or of race or of skill, which often have divided the working class. In other words, the era of resistance is so remarkable because it allows for this kind of communal-wide solidarity, which is a rare phenomenon in the history of popular politics in America, and for that matter, anywhere else.
Even rare during this period.
And even rare during this period. But it happens. It happens. For instance, there is a real alliance between white and black populists in the countryside, in the South. There are separate farmers' alliances, the Colored Farmer Alliance and the Farmers' Alliance, which is for white farmers. But they collaborate, they work together, and the Southern oligarchy goes way out of its way to play the race card and eventually successfully to undo that alliance.
We also saw this dynamic with miner strikes.
Absolutely, yes. When the miners were for a long time an integrated union, I don't mean to say there wasn't discrimination within the ranks of the miners' union, who got promoted, who got the best jobs, who got seniority, etc. Nonetheless, there was not this, you know, the labor union movement tended to be lily white and skilled in those days. It excluded not only blacks, but women, unskilled workers, and so on. But there were these moments where that was not the case. And the CIO in the 1930s, you need to remember, despite all the charges that can be made against the CIO about race discrimination, nonetheless, those strikes, whether they were at General Motors or the rubber companies in Akron, or all through the South, for example, embraced black and white workers. And for many African-American workers, it's the first way out of the kind of peonage that they had suffered under in the Southern cotton economy.
Well, you write that the abolition movement before the Civil War was still fresh in people's minds, that also helped create this atmosphere of insurrection in the country.
Yes, that's right. The abolitionists and the abolitionist movement more generally, were very sensitive to, obviously, to slavery, but because there was such a high sensitivity to slavery as a form of intolerable dependency, because of that, there became a kindred sense that, well, wait a second, we may get rid of chattel slavery, but what is this wage slavery? What is a man or woman who is so dependent on the owners of capital that he may be free, he may be a free laborer, but really, how free is he? He's free to work at whatever wages and at whatever conditions are offered to him by capital, or free to starve. That's the freedom he has. And that critique of wage labor as a new form of slavery is an inheritance of the abolitionist antipathy to slavery.
This is not just a story when we talk about the uprisings during the first Gilded Age of men. You also write about garment workers in the early 1900s in New York City. Can you tell me about them?
Yes, yes. I mean, there are great uprisings by the garment workers in New York, also elsewhere in Chicago and many other cities. And many of these workers are women, and these strikes and insurrections are led by women. There's what's called the Uprising of the 20,000 in New York, the early garment unions, the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America. These are born out of these insurrections. They are largely ethnic, that is, immigrant insurrections of Jewish, Italian, Polish, Bohemian workers. There are the great strikes led by the IWW in Paterson, New Jersey, among the silk workers, in Lawrence, Massachusetts, among the textile workers, again, many of whom are women. These strikes are often not only led by women, but enlist the support of women who are not in the workforce to support the strike on the outside. These mass strikes really embrace the whole community. Let me make this point too. These strikes also electrify non-working class populations, so that the whole world of Greenwich Village bohemian art springs to the defense of the Paterson and Lawrence workers, raise money, hold theatrical pageants, write all kinds of articles defending the needs and desires of these workers. Some of our greatest novelists, what I'm saying is this is part of a broad cultural phenomenon. Some of our greatest novelists write about this great social divide in American life. You know, The Hazard of New Fortunes, William Dean Howells, maybe his best novel, it depicts this confrontation. And in fact, uses a very violent strike of Brooklyn streetcar workers as the culmination of that novel's drama. That Howells became one of the leaders of the movement to stop the execution of the Haymarket anarchist bombers in 1886. Theodore Dreiser, Jack London, who, by the way, was one of the, joined one of those armies of the unemployed during the 1890s depression, writes, as probably many of your listeners know, about this savage oligopoly, oligarchy and plutocracy that's dominating the country. You have clerics who say, look, this is an offense against Christianity. Imagine that today. It's so rare today. But then something called the social gospel was quite common, that capitalism was so brutal and depraved in the way it behaved towards people that it was anti-Christian. So argued these social gospel ministers, some of whom were quite influential.
Yeah, Jack London even got arrested on the steps of Oakland City Hall preaching socialism, as he also ran for mayor of the city of Oakland. Steve Frazier, as we move to wrap up, looking back at what's happening today, we had the Occupy Wall Street movement. We have this movement in our midst now of fast food workers striking for $15 an hour. We have the Black Lives Matter movement. It seems to me that there is a more militant aspect to movements today. Maybe not on a large scale, though the Black Lives Matter protests were very large, but maybe not what we've seen from 100 years ago yet, but perhaps moving that way.
Yes, I completely agree with you. There are these signs, and they're heartening signs, and you've mentioned some of them: fast food workers, car wash workers, tomato pickers, the Black Lives Matter, obviously, even the new political populism that's cropped up here and there, say with the election of de Blasio in New York City, or even a socialist in Seattle to the city council, the new minimum wages that have become more and living wages.
is ordinances that have become more and more commonplace. You know, it's in the air, and it may or may not continue. Nobody knows. I often give this example. If you had taken a snapshot of the country in 1932 at the depths of the Great Depression, you would have seen a deeply demoralized, depressed, cynical, inert population. If you had taken that same photograph 2 years later, you wouldn't have recognized the country. It was full of the kinds of mass movements, political and street level movements that I talked about before, the sit down strikes and the general strikes and the farmer and labor parties and so on. It's very hard to predict how or why people finally say, I've had enough and I'm going to try something new and take the risk to do it because it's very risky. But I think we are beginning to see the signs of that today.
Steve Frazier, thank you for your time.
Thanks very much.
Again, the name of the book is The Age of Acquiescence, The Life and Death of American Resistance to Organized Wealth and Power. And that does it for Letters and Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez. Kristen Thomas is our engineer. You can find archives of our previous shows online at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next...
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. Is the U.S. ramping up its military presence in Syria and preparing to attack Iran for Israel? Wilkerson is a retired U.S. colonel and former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. Since the end of his military career, Wilkerson has publicly criticized many aspects of the Iraq War, including his own preparation of Colin Powell's presentation to the United Nations. Wilkerson gained the respect of many when he said that his uncritical acceptance of the claim that Iraq had chemical weapons was probably the biggest mistake of my life, end quote by Wilkerson. In particular, Wilkerson has denounced the decision-making process of the Bush administration and Vice President Dick Cheney and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld's parts in it. Before working for the State Department, Wilkerson served 31 years in the U.S. Armed Services. He retired from active duty in 1997 and currently is a distinguished visiting professor of government and public policy at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia. And he's working on a book about the first George Bush administration. In April 2007, Wilkerson was featured in a Dutch documentary entitled The Israel Lobby. He said that the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, was highly influential in the Bush administration's decision to go to war in Iraq. Today he makes the case that APAC plays a major role again in the current campaign to launch war against Iran. On March 2, 2018, Lawrence Wilkerson spoke at the annual conference on the Israel lobby held at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., and organized by the Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy, and the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. He began his presentation by referring to the mysterious way in which Israel acquired nuclear weapons and expressed his agreement with the previous speaker, Jefferson Morley. Morley attended Yale University and is a veteran Washington investigative reporter and author of the best-selling book, The Ghost, The Secret Life of CIA Spymaster James Jesus Angleton. Jefferson Morley had explained in his talk how Israel managed to steal the enriched uranium for its nuclear weapons from the NUMEC plant in Apollo, Pennsylvania. This is what he said.
The Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation, otherwise known as NUMEC, started processing highly enriched uranium in the United States in 1959. NUMEC had been created by David Lowenthal, a Zionist financier who financed the post-war boat lift from Europe to Palestine that was romanticized in the book and movie Exodus. He hired Zalman Shapiro, a brilliant young metallurgist, to run the company. At that time, the U.S. government owned all of supplies of nuclear fuel, which private companies like NUMEC were allowed to use, but ultimately had to return to the government. Within a few years, the Atomic Energy Commission noticed worrisome signs that the Apollo plant, NUMEC had a plant in Apollo, Pennsylvania, that the plant's security and accounting were very deficient. Unexplained losses of nuclear material did happen at other companies, but NUMEC's losses were proportionally much larger. By October 1965, the AEC estimated that 178 kilograms of highly enriched uranium had gone missing from the NUMEC facility. By March 1968, that figure was 267 kilograms. John Haddon, was the CIA station chief in Israel from 1964 to 1967 and worked very closely with Angleton throughout this period. And he would later concur with the near-unanimous assessment of CIA's nuclear scientists that Israel had indeed stolen fissile material from NUMEC and used it to build their nuclear arsenal. This story is now very well documented. In the spring of 1965, a technician working at the night shift at NUMEC went out on a loading dock for a breath of fresh air and saw an unusual sight. Zalman Shapiro was pacing on the dock while a foreman and truck driver loaded cylindrical storage containers known as stovepipes onto a flatbed truck. The technician saw a clipboard saying that the material was destined for Israel. It was highly unusual to see Dr. Shapiro in the manufacturing section of the Apollo nuclear facility, the technician said. It was unusual to see Dr. Shapiro there at night, and it was very unusual to see Dr. Shapiro so nervous. The next day, NUMEC's personnel manager visited the technician and threatened to fire him if he did not keep his mouth shut, that's a quote, concerning what he had seen. It would be 15 years before the employee told the story to the FBI. With the fissile material diverted from NUMEC, Israel was able to construct its first nuclear weapon by 1967 and become a full-blown nuclear power by 1970, the first and still the only nuclear power in the Middle East.
That was Jefferson Morley. He spoke before Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who expressed his agreement with Morley's historic account. Here is Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Thank you all for being here. I'm the last speaker. I get that distinction. I have to identify myself with the remarks that were just made. Over some 400 students, graduate and undergraduate, and 12 years on two university campuses and 6 years with about 1,000 students at two of the nation's most prestigious war colleges, we have determined, although it would be probably difficult to prove, and that's the reason we have covert operations, that Lyndon Johnson not only knew the gory details of the Israeli attack on USS Liberty in the Eastern Mediterranean, he also knew about what was just told you. That is to say, he knew the uranium was being diverted, he knew Israel was building a bomb, and he chose not to do anything about it. That's not my subject today, although I could talk on that sort of thing forever, as I'm sure Jefferson could too. These days, I believe one gets the best insights into Israeli security policy and perhaps even into Israeli policy writ large, which you've heard a lot about today, from the Russian emigre to Israel, a former foreign minister, and now its defense minister, Avigdor Lieberman. Whether it's his calling Arab members of the Knesset war criminals, or declaring the Jewish people should leave France, or claiming that the next military action against Hamas in Gaza will be the last, or contradicting his own military chief by denying there is a humanitarian crisis in Gaza, or stating categorically that the IDF will stop at nothing in order to win, reminding me a great deal of Dick Cheney, Lieberman is the living face of Bibi Netanyahu's Zionist policies. I sometimes think he would have rather remained in Russia so long as it was the Soviet Union and so long as he were in a significant position of power there. In addition to reminding me of Cheney, he is reminiscent of, and indeed might well be a latent version of, Joseph Stalin. As an aside, it is intriguing, and I think well outside the usual conspiracy theory, to consider whether or not Lieberman has been intimated of our own President Trump might be an NKVD, GRU, KGB, FSB, you name it, plant. That is an agent of Vladimir Putin. He has more or less forged most of the 1 million Russian emigres since 1991 into a formidable political force, forming the political party that has more than once played kingmaker in the Israeli political scene. What a strategic coup for Vladimir, the master chess player in the world today, in my estimation, while everyone else plays a really lousy game of checkers. It would be quite a coup for him. Of far more concern at the moment and readily provable, unlike what I just said, Lieberman exemplifies where Israel is headed. toward a massive confrontation with the various powers arrayed against it, a confrontation that will suck America in and perhaps terminate the experiment that is Israel and do irreparable damage to the empire that America has become.
You're listening to Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. He spoke on the topic, is the U.S. ramping up its military presence in Syria and preparing to attack Iran for Israel? When he gave this speech on March 2, 2018, Wilkerson predicted that Israel's defense minister, Avigdor Lieberman, would argue in favor of war on Iran at the annual meeting of the Jerusalem Post. That meeting since has taken place, and Wilkerson's prediction was correct. Here is Avigdor Lieberman. He spoke in New York City on April 29, 2018.
No doubt, as one my colleague said in the past, we have three problems: Iran, Iran, and Iran. Iran is trying to turn all Syria to be forward-based against Israel. And they are doing some concrete steps, and we're not ready to allow. We will prevent at any cost from Iranian to establish forward base against Israel on Syrian soil. Again, only to clarify our position, we keep really for us freedom of operation in all Syria. Today we enjoy really, really very, very close relations with this administration, all key people from president, vice president, national security advisor, secretary of state, secretary of defense, Nikki Haley, the ambassador to UN, all of them, really friends.
Seems like people like her.
All of them, old friends of Israel, and we have full understanding and full cooperation. And again, I can only express my appreciation to our friends in this administration. I think it's really something unbelievable how strong our ties.
Avigdor Lieberman, Israel's defense minister. Back to Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
And nowhere does my concern about such a war focus more acutely at the moment than in Syria. As President of France, Emmanuel Macron, described it recently, quote, the current rhetoric of the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Israel is pushing the region toward conflict with Iran, unquote. In that triad, no state is doing that more than Israel. Listen to Netanyahu in January at the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Jerusalem. Quote, the greatest danger that we face of hatred for the Jewish people and the Jewish state comes from Iran. It comes from the Ayatollah regime that is fanning the flames of anti-Semitism, unquote. This anti-Semitism bit, of course, as we've heard today, almost always a weapon of choice for Israeli politicians under stress, hurled in this case at the country whose Jewish population, by the way, the largest in the Middle East outside Turkey and Israel, lives in Iran in reasonable peace. And don't forget that these words are uttered by the man who is, as we've heard here today briefly, doing everything he can to expel dark-skinned African refugees, largely from Eritrea and the Sudan, from Israel, where most have come as legitimate refugees. President Trump's wall on the Mexican border is nothing compared to Bibi's actual policies. More recently, Bibi's performance at the Munich Security Conference bordered on the infantile, and yet effective when you think about the audience to whom he's speaking, as he held aloft an alleged piece on an alleged Iranian drone and asked Monsieur Zarif if he recognized it. Of course, Mr. Zarif later took his occasion at the microphone to characterize Netanyahu's performance as like that of a circus clown. Pretty good characterization, as a matter of fact. But I like the comment of Lebanon's defense minister even better. It went to the point. He said that he had an Israeli drone over his head virtually 24/7. That comment put the hypocrite that Netanyahu is in the right perspective. Of late, of course, Tel Aviv is increasingly using Iran's presence in Syria, its support for President Bashar al-Assad, and its alleged drive, and I love this one, my military comrades love it too, for a Shia corridor from Tehran to Aden as the hoary beast that must not be at any cost, including, of course, American treasure and lives, as his probable cause and existential prompt for action. That Israel has in support such disparate figures as Nikki Haley at the United Nations, Jim Mattis at the Pentagon, as well as the usual suspects from outside the world of warmed-over neoconservatives, is indicative of such policy. But it's not just the usual suspects from the world of neocons, about whom I know quite a bit, having experienced them in 2001 and 2 and 3. Take, for example, my fellow South Carolinian, Lindsey Graham, speaking 4 days ago after a breathless trip to Israel, a bipartisan trip, he called it. I don't know how anybody could use that term. And I caution, don't laugh, because Lindsey was serious, I think, but anything bipartisan with regard to Israel, call it unanimity, call it absolute unanimity, anything but bipartisan. In fact, the proper words are probably overwhelming and unprecedented unanimity. In fact, the only issue that does unify the United States Congress, other than mom and apple pie. But Graham had this to say, quote, "Anytime you leave a meeting where the request is ammunition, 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 that's probably not good." That's Lindsey. That's Lindsey. Know Lindsey well. "This was the most unnerving trip I've had in a while," he said breathlessly again. Graham went on to assert that, quote, when they tell you we won't help to deal with the blowback that might come from attacks on civilian targets where Hezbollah has integrated military capability, that was so striking. That was striking, end of quote. And then Senator Coons, who up until this time I've had some respect for, fairly sane and sober senator from Delaware, reported that, quote, "the tempo in terms of potential for conflict in Syria has gone up astronomically. The technologies Iran is projecting into Syria and southern Lebanon has gone up. Iran's willingness to be provocative, to push the edges of the envelope, to challenge Israel has gone up," end of quote. Coons reported this almost as breathlessly as Lindsey. With the highest tech nation on earth in Syria, the United States of America, that is all Coons could derive from his visit. That the country that spends less than 1% of what the U.S. spends on its national security has introduced new technologies in Syria, technologies that threaten the country Israel, to whom the U.S. bounty is limitless. This is Joseph Goebbels' territory. Karl Rove is envious. The Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, as the heir to the Project for a New American Century, Bill Kristol's Iraq-bound think tank, leads that pack of wolves disguised as warmed-over neocons, lavishly funded by the likes of Paul Singer. It's even spawned the Institute for the Study of War, a fascinating Orwellian title if there ever was one. It should be the Institute for War. I've been asked, why is it that you ascribe to FDD and now the ISW such nefarious motives? I was asked this by the New York Times editorial staff when they published my op-ed on Iran a few days ago. My answer is simple, because that is precisely what FDD is attempting to do. Just as Douglas Feiss, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Office of Special Plans, did in 2002 and 2003 for Richard Bruce Cheney, to lead us into war with Iraq. I've been there, done that. I don't need the tour. The salient question, though, why do you believe that America is headed for a struggle with Iran, needs an answer. Certainly, America's unquestioning support is required, as has been the case from George W. Bush to Barack Obama to the rapture-seeking Mike Pence and the tweeter and king Donald Trump. But it seems that recently, Lieberman and Netanyahu and their acolytes in this country, amongst which I put at the top Nikki Haley, have determined that it would be best if American troops also participated in the overthrow of the Tehran regime. From one point of view, I suppose this is understandable, the crassly opportunistic point of view, that is, that better to squander your own allies' blood and treasure than your own. But it's certainly not in the character that I'm used to with regard to the state of Israel, and certainly not with regard to the Israeli Defense Force. That force could handle anything Iran threw at it militarily is undeniable. Any military professional will tell you that. And that Israel's more than 200 nuclear warheads could decimate Iran is equally undeniable. So why this attempt to suck America into this conflict? I believe the answer is fairly clear once you push aside the cobwebs that surround it. The legitimacy of great power is what I call it, and that is precisely what Netanyahu and Lieberman desire. It's also what Riyadh desires, especially with the new boy king, Mohammed bin Salman. Now an erstwhile ally of Israel. In short, the IDF could defend Israel, but it could not attack Iran, not successfully anyway. And were it to do so, it would be damned internationally and thus isolated even more than it already is today, perhaps devastatingly so. But America, already damned by well more than half the world, polls show at least 4 billion people think we're the number one threat to their security in the world. Think about that for a minute. We've already done Iraq, Libya, and Syria, Afghanistan. We'd just be seen as continuing the trend. Besides, America has the military capacity, and here's the long pole in the tent, to project the power needed to unseat swiftly the regime in Tehran. Swiftly in terms of Saddam Hussein, for example, not swiftly in terms of taking care of 75 million people, each one of which in a very rugged and strategically deep terrain would want to kill every damned American in the country, along with probably half the rest of the Arabs in the area. So, there's only one significant hang-up that I see with this strategy that Netanyahu and Lieberman are pushing. Embroiled in his own legal problems that just might send him to jail, as such problems would likely have sent Arik Sharon to jail had he not been in really bad shape at the end of his prime ministership, they're both headed for war. Of that, I'm convinced. They will use Iran's allegedly existential to Israel presence in Syria, which is becoming even more so from a military perspective every day. Hezbollah's accumulation of some 150,000 missiles, if we believe our intelligence agencies. The need to set Lebanon's economy back yet again. That's important. Look at what they're deliberating right now with regard to the new, very, very rich gas find in the eastern Mediterranean, with Israel claiming Section 9 and Lebanon claiming Section 9. Take that, Lebanon. We're going to bomb you. Then you'll let us have it. And that will be their excuse. And we're looking at them taking on, and this is a point that all military people understand, a country that couldn't beat Iraq in 8 years of brutal, bloody war. An Iraq that we beat in 19 days. So this is the colossal threat that they're up against. And men such as H.R. McMaster are helping them. The much-heralded author of Dereliction of Duty, great title, and a man who knows about as much about Iran as I do about the 8th planet in the 95th solar system in the 50th galaxy past our own. And here's a hope I have. Let's hope that the chess master-in-chief, old Vladimir Putin, he that ruins elections from Paris to Peoria, is smart enough, once again, not to let this happen. I fear he'll not be, and we might have the stirrings of 1914, as utterly stupid as we now know those stirrings to have been. People to whom I mention such possibilities, people who are critically analytical and normally fairly sound in their thinking, respond that, well, don't you consider that sort of dreary prognosis a little bit overdrawn? My rejoinder is usually something a bit too clever, perhaps, but along these lines, don't you think a number of people said that in the summer of 1914? Ah, they respond, but have we not learned so much since then? I'll let you be the judge of that and inform you only that in my considered view, we have learned very little, and there are the ingredients right now with Turkey, Syria, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia losing dramatically in Yemen right now, and the United States and Russia at the peak of all of this to get engaged, a very distinct possibility. I looked at this from the perspective of the political parameters. What is it that we're confronting today in this country? And this took me down an entirely different path as I tried to figure out just how this team of McMaster, Kelly et al., and Trump at the top of it will face this sort of decision-making process. And the only place I could find that remotely resembled where we are today in our past was the period 1850 to 1860. And so about 6 months ago, I started reading as voraciously as I could on that period. I'd done some reading, but I needed to really do a lot more. It is stunning, the similarities between that period and now, particularly in the political situation where one side of the country wouldn't talk to the other side of the country and vice versa. And I was struck today by some of the comments that were made that resemble the comments that were made by my region, my state fired on Fort Sumter, after all, back in those days. And if that is the political situation in which this government will do its national security decision-making, then we are in deeper trouble than even the prospects of a region-wide and perhaps even bigger war in the Middle East. And the country that will have started it all, the relationship, unbalanced as it is, that will have made it possible, is Israel. And that's the danger we face.
That was Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, recorded in March 2018. He spoke on the topic, is the U.S. ramping up its military presence in Syria and preparing to attack Iran for Israel? Wilkerson is a retired U.S. colonel and former chief of staff to U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell. Before working at the State Department, Wilkerson served 31 years in the U.S. Armed Services. He retired from active duty in 1997 and currently is a distinguished visiting professor of government and public policy at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia. He makes the case that AIPAC plays a major role again in the current campaign to launch war against Iran. On March 2, 2018, Lawrence Wilkerson spoke at the annual conference on the Israel Lobby, held at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., and organized by the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy and the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelaiden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
So the right to stay home actually includes both of these rights. It includes the right to an alternative to being forced into migration, but it also means that if you do decide to leave home and to work as a migrant in another country, you have a right to social equality. You have some political rights. You have economic rights.
That's the voice of David Bacon. On this week's show, we speak to David about his latest book, The Right to Stay Home, How U.S. Policy Drives Mexican Migration. So stay tuned.
We're very privileged to be joined by author David Bacon. He is the author of Illegal People, How Globalization Creates Migration and Criminalizes Immigrants. Welcome to our show, David.
Hi, Sylvia.
So great to hear your voice. Now, we are looking at a world that is, you know, filled with struggle. Wherever we look, whether it's Greece, Spain, Latin America, we see people rising against the capitalist system. And we often are presented with very limited options, either austerity or economic collapse. What is the story that is missing from this very narrow perspective of how the world is organized and how the world can function?
Well, I think that the reason why there's such an enormous push for austerity is because we still live in a world that does not look that different from the old colonial world when the U.S., European countries, Japan, divided up the world and then proceeded to basically take the wealth that was in the countries that were the colonies and bring it to the metropolitan countries. So, and that has enormous consequences. And what I'm thinking about, Sylvia, is the recent publicity that we've seen in the media about the deaths of people in Europe, the people who are especially crossing the Mediterranean, trying to reach Lampedusa and Sicily, and also people who are now traveling overland through Turkey and then into Greece and then up through the Balkans into Western Europe. Part of the reason why people are coming is because of the wars that are devastating countries like Syria, many of the countries of North Africa. But these wars are themselves the product of trying to maintain an unjust world order. In other words, if we look at Libya, for instance, I think that the intervention in Libya that led to the downfall of Muammar Gaddafi, now looking for the moment at what kind of regime he had in Libya, but the main reason for the intervention was to essentially expropriate and continue to expropriate the oil in Libya. And as a result of that, Libya has turned into a country that is very violent, one in which there are different armed groups fighting each other, and the oil in Libya is going to wind up back in the hands of large corporations. So the purpose of the intervention really was to capture and maintain control of that oil, in other words, the natural resources. And when you look throughout Africa and the Middle East, you see the same kind of thing going on. You know, the oil of Nigeria winds up coming to Europe. The profits from the sale of it stay in Europe. They don't go back to Nigeria, at least not a lot of them. And Nigerians, in the meantime, are forced into migration to Europe, and so you find people who are, you know, selling knockoff handbags in the plazas in the streets of Rome because they can't make a living at home. So the consequences of the sort of the ripoff of the resources of Africa is, you know, that the people of those countries can't really make a living there and wind up coming to the countries that were their original colonizers. And then the wars that get fought to ensure that this situation doesn't change also produce an enormous amount of displacement. You know, we have millions of people who have been leaving Iraq and leaving Syria, and these are really wars that are fought in order to make sure that Western Europe, the United States, continue to kind of occupy the dominant positions in an economic world order.
You know, when you talk about not only the implications of maintaining a system that is so inequitable and unjust, you know, that produces so much suffering and so much violence. In many ways, the violence is both the military intervention, but it's also the economic warfare against the working class. Can we talk a little bit about the numbers of immigrants that this this policy of globalization, and to me it's neoliberalism really, because globalization, the world, there's always been people, you know, mobilizing on the global scale, but this liberalization of capital and this idea of companies having the right to impose practices that devalue workers' productivity, that devalue the worth of what, you know, one worker produces in one area and poses them against another worker, say Mexico and Canada, for instance. So I wonder if you could maybe talk a little bit about the relationships that create, that are maintaining. How are these relationships not only naturalize the violence against the people, but also the double edge of criminalization of the workers who, you know, who escape those conditions and come to the U.S. or Europe?
Well, first of all, in terms of just the numbers, the number of people who are living outside the countries where they were born, according to the UNHCR, the UN High Commission on Refugees, is about 300 million people in the world today. But I think that's really actually a pretty gross underestimate, and it also doesn't really take into account the internal migration. In other words, people who are displaced and forced to leave home but don't necessarily cross borders. You know, there are, for instance, hundreds of millions of people in China who are migrating from the countryside in China to the cities, essentially because of the difference in the standard of living in China between the countryside and the cities. And so this is a migration, in other words, economic migration as well, too. I think that this was recently highlighted by President Obama, who went to visit the homeland of his father, Kenya, on his recent trip to Africa, and, you know, talked about the need for modernizing the economies of Africa, and then especially of Eastern Africa and Kenya. The reality is that just 3 years ago, Kenya was presented with what was called an economic partnership agreement between Kenya and the European Union. And essentially, this agreement would have allowed large European corporations to operate freely in Kenya, in other words, to dump manufactured goods, for instance, on the market in Kenya and prevent the growth of a native industry in Kenya itself, as well as to hold down the prices of agricultural goods and to serve as sort of like a dumping ground for surplus agricultural products from Europe. So Kenya originally refused to sign that agreement and then was told by European countries that they would impose extremely high tariffs and other customs duties on its exports to Europe. And the economy of Kenya, like most developing countries, has become dependent on markets now in wealthy countries. So that was a very, very powerful threat to make. And eventually the Kenyan government surrendered and signed that agreement. And that's no, you know, in no coincidence, you know, Kenyans are arriving in Europe and in, even in the United States today as migrants, essentially for economic reasons. So again, you know, this is the sort of the shaping of the economies of developing countries for the interests of, you know, large corporations, with the governments of, you know, the United States and European governments, and Canada does the same thing, especially under under Harper these days, has essentially the same policy. Canadian mining companies, for instance, are the main mining companies operating now in Mexico and in Central America, causing enormous environmental devastation to rural communities and, again, resulting in the displacement of people. So what happens to people when they become displaced in this way is they then become part of the workforce in wealthy countries and developed countries, Europe, United States, Canada, Japan, and so forth. And that workforce, the place where they enter the workforce is at the bottom. In other words, they become some of the lowest paid workers working in some of the most dangerous and unpleasant conditions. And this kind of position that immigrant workers find themselves in is reinforced by the lack of legal status for many of those migrants. You know, in the United States, we have probably about 12 million people here who don't have any kind of legal status. What that means is that it's easy for employers to threaten people and to tell people that, you know, if they don't work an extra hour of overtime without getting overtime pay, that the employer will fire them because of their immigration status, which is happening quite a lot. And even worse than that, people can wind up becoming deportable. And we also have programs that bring people from those countries to metropolitan countries as low-wage labor. Canada and the United States both have large guest worker programs, which essentially treat people who are coming to Canada and the U.S. as being workers who are going to work for wages that are at the bottom, people who don't acquire the right to live permanently in either of these two countries, and who basically have a kind of a social and political status which excludes them from the rights and the protections that other workers have. So this is a very conscious effort, essentially, to channel the people who are being displaced, in other words, people who can't really survive in their countries of origin, into places in the economies of wealthy countries where their labor can be put to good use and at a very low pay.
You know, I wonder if we could talk a little bit about that, because, I mean, many Canadians and a lot of Americans, I presume, also. But when you talk to workers, they say, you know, well, it makes sense that a worker should come here with a visa, a working visa. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this, the significance of this policy that invites workers as so-called guest workers, and the implication that this has for labor organizations in Canada and the U.S., because it is a double sword for the immigrants. You know, as I've experienced, many of the immigrants are told they're welcome to come here, but that so-called guest working visa also indicates a kind of double-tier system for workers. And I wonder if you could maybe touch on the significance for our labor movements in North America and why it's important for us to not only acknowledge the inequalities that cause people to be displaced, to cause people to leave their countries of origin and face such marginal and unsafe conditions.
The key question to look at here is, you know, what the conditions of the visa are. In other words, what kind of rights do visa holders have? There in Vancouver, there's a very important organization, Justicia for Migrant Workers, which for a long time has said that the people who are arriving in Canada on guest worker visas should be given the right to stay in Canada, to have their families with them, to basically live in a kind of social status that is the same as anybody else in Canada. And there are organizations like the Frente Indígena de Organizaciones Binacionales in the United States that advocates for the same kind of thing here. The problem with the guest worker visa is that essentially what it does is it does two things. First of all, it sets up a system in which employers go and recruit workers in their countries of origin. And as they say, you know, who pays the musicians, you know, calls the tune. So, in other words, that if people are brought to the U.S. or to Canada by employers, when those employers bring them with the expectation, and not just the expectation, but with the legal requirement, that the people that they bring work for them. So, in other words, it's not a free situation in which people can kind of look for a job and find one wherever they want, you know, and looking essentially for the best paying job. These are workers who then are brought to Canada and the U.S. and who are held in that kind of employment status in which their wages are at the bottom. They're temporary arrangements. In other words, you don't have the right to stay in Canada. You don't have the right to stay in the United States. When your work contract is up, you have to leave. And if you lose your job, if your employer decides to fire you, for instance, because you join a union, which has happened in nurseries and greenhouses in Ambi, then you lose your ability to stay. You lose your visa. So that's why they're called work visas, is because your ability to stay in the country is connected to your work and to your job. The other kind of visa is one that allows people to become permanent residents. In other words, that says that even though you're not a citizen, you can live in Canada and the United States. You can live where you want. You can work or you cannot work as you want. You can work wherever you want. And you have the same rights to join unions. You can fight for higher wages. There are still some restrictions in the United States, especially because people not having citizenship status, they can't vote, which is a very big problem for us because in certain areas of the United States, we have many, many, many thousands of workers who are not citizens and who can't vote. And consequently, the political structure, the areas where people are living is dominated by their employers rather than by workers themselves. I'm thinking especially of the rural areas in California here. Nevertheless, a permanent resident visa, what the United States is called the green card, is a kind of visa that gives people rights that a work visa and a guest worker does not. That's why employers like guest worker programs. In fact, that's why there's a big push on in both of our countries to expand these programs and to bring more and more workers. They are especially problematic for unions because what happens essentially is that when workers in the country on guest worker visas get upset and decide that they don't like the wages that they are being paid and decide that they want to organize a union like the United Food and Commercial Workers, which has organized some of the greenhouses and nurseries in British Columbia, employers fire those workers and then proceed to deport them with the help of the Mexican consulate. In other words, the Mexican consulate will go to guest workers and say, you know, don't go out on strike. Don't cause problems. You know, don't speak out, because if you do that, you're going to make these programs much less attractive to the Canadian government and to Canadian employers. And so that's a big problem for unions, because what it really means is that you have a workforce that is very fearful of the risks that are involved in organizing because of what conceivably can happen to people.
David, we've been talking about the impact that globalization has had and how this deepening of poverty not only forces people to migrate, but the kind of insecurity that this creates for workers worldwide. Can we talk a little bit about your book, The Right to Stay Home? What inspired you to write this book?
Well, the reason why it's called The Right to Stay Home, Sylvia, is because there is a growing movement. Well, in the case of this book, what I'm especially looking at is Mexico and especially the state of Oaxaca. But this movement exists in other countries as well, too, especially, for instance, the Philippines and some others, in which people are saying, first of all, that they want to have an alternative to being forced into migration because of the lack of any other way for families and for communities to survive economically. So So in Oaxaca, for instance, people were very, very strongly affected by the North American Free Trade Agreement because it allowed U.S. corporations to dump corn on the Mexican market at such a low price that it essentially made it impossible for farmers in Oaxaca to grow corn and sell it for a price that would pay for the cost of growing it. And the big irony, of course, is that corn cultivation started in Oaxaca thousands of years ago. So here we are forcing off of the land people who were responsible for the fact that we're able to eat corn to begin with. But in those communities, people are saying, well, that something has to change here, that this system is not a fair and a just system, that people should be able to grow up and live and have a decent life in Oaxaca, which means in this case that there would have to be higher prices for agricultural products. It would mean restricting foreign corporations. It would mean getting rid of the North American Free Trade Agreement. But people are also saying that, you know, they need the same basic things that all working people need: good schools, a healthcare system, jobs, and so forth. And in order to get those in Oaxaca, people need political change. So the movements that are talking about this, like the Frente Indígena, are also movements that are calling for political change. You could say that the Zapatistas were calling for the same thing when they rose up in rebellion in Chiapas in 1994. So the right to stay home really means the right for an alternative to forced migration. Now, we're talking about communities that are very dependent on migration, because the world has advanced quite a bit from the time when people first started leaving their homes in Oaxaca looking for some other way of earning a living. So you have communities in Oaxaca in which many, many, many family members are already working in the United States and in Canada, for that matter. And so the right to stay home is also goes along with the rights of migrants. So these communities are saying that if we leave home, we have a right to be treated with dignity and respect in the countries that we go to and work. We have the right to make a decent wage. We have the right to join a union. We have a right not to be deported or to be thrown into some kind of detention center. But we also have the right to decide whether or not we want to migrate to begin with. In other words, migration should be a voluntary process and not one that's forced on people. So the right to stay home actually includes both of these rights. It includes the right to an alternative to being forced into migration, but it also means that if you do decide to leave home and to work as a migrant in another country, you have a right to social equality. You have some political rights. You have economic rights. So this is really, I think, a not exactly a new way of looking at migration, but it's one that I think is a very humanistic way of looking at migration. This is a sort of a point of view that is arising from people themselves and solutions that are being voiced by those communities that are most involved in the system of migration as it is in the world today.
I also think that it's important to note that while the struggle today seems to be one that it's an uphill, you know, mode, right? When we look at Greece, when we look at Latin America, when we look at many of the economic coups that are happening worldwide, it would seem that our struggles are perhaps unfruitful. But I think your book reflects that this growing movement, it's an exemplary of how connected we all are, you know, as workers, as people worldwide, in this ideal of a world with justice, a world with dignity. And I think if there is one concept that perhaps embraces the work that you do, is that of dignity, that every human being has inherent value and that we all do better, you know, when we all treat each other with that dignity, with that, you know, inherent value. How can people access your work? How can people get involved and become catalysts of social change in our communities?
United Food and Commercial Workers in Canada and British Columbia is very much involved in organizing, helping immigrant workers to organize unions. So that's one way. And then right across the border, there's a big organizing effort, including a number of strikes that have taken place this year in Bellingham, near Bellingham, by Oaxacan migrant workers at a ranch called Sukuma Farms. And they've set up an independent union called Familias Unidas por la Justicia, and they're calling for a boycott of Driscoll Berries because Driscoll is the corporation that's responsible for the problems that they're facing at work. So that's another way that you can help as well, too.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is David Bacon. He is a beautiful writer, and his books are amazing. His latest book, The Right to Stay Home, How U.S. Policy Drives Mexican Migration. Thank you so much for being with us. And give us our website, your website once more so people know how to access your books.
Sure. It's like my name, dbacon@igc.org.
Thank you again. We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.